Good evening, everyone. Okay, we're going to welcome you and call this meeting to order and welcome you to the supervisors' meeting on this day, December the 6th, 2023. We're going to ask that you stand and we will do the pledge of allegiance in a moment of silence.
Well, they're gone.
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can we add just one more discussion?
All right.
It's to discuss the nonprofit work session. But the last meeting, the board wanted to push back the December nonprofit work session. So I think the discussion was to have the new board in place to hear all the nonprofits. So I just want to have a quick discussion.
Can we have someone to adopt?
So may.
All right, we have to adopt the agenda by Mr. Sherman and second by Mr. Wine. All in favor?
Aye.
All right, the chair votes aye, and Mrs. Eager is absent this afternoon. Now, Mr. Dahl, we will have your comments.
I do, Madam Chair, members of the board. It's a few things to report this evening. So I just announced some new employees that started with the county. Milo Curcio, hopefully I didn't butcher his name, I probably did, started in the Emergency Services Department as an EMT ALS. He started November 27th. Danielle Robertson with Social Services. She started November 27th. She is a Benefits Program Specialist 3. We also have Luke Sheridan, who started in the E911 department as a E911 Communications Officer, started December 5th, 2023. And then Colin Gates, a deputy in training for the Sheriff's Office, and he started December 4th. So certainly want to welcome all those new employees to the county. Just a couple things, spotlight on business. So Studio 55 is a local handcrafts vendor mall. So there's a ribbon cutting ceremony, which will be December 8th at 3 p.m. It's at the Village Station, just kind of in the downtown Palmyra area. And so again, that's at 13652 James Madison Highway. And again, it's December 8th at 3 p.m. And the Palmyra Arts Fest also is Saturday, December 9th, and that's going to be from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And it's at the Stone Jail Street, just some kind of the villages of Palmyra. There'll be local artisans, performers, food trucks, and children's activities. And then there is a rain date, but again, Saturday, December 9th, there'll be 24 local vendors, food trucks, face paint, free make and take crafts, and Santa arrives at 11 a.m. And I think this is the last one. So Fort Union has a lights up tree lighting event December 9th from 4 to 8 p.m. December 10th from 3 to 7 p.m. There'll be free refreshments and carriage rides. And just some upcoming meetings we have. So December 20th is of the calendar year is your last meeting of the calendar year. That's a 7 p.m. regular meeting. January 3rd at 5 p.m. we will have our organizational and regular meeting. January 3rd at 7 p.m. we will also have that same day a solar informational work session, and then January 17th at 7 p.m. we have a regular meeting, and then once we get to some of the discussion under new business under work sessions, we may have a couple tweaks of some things, but that's all I have to report this evening.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Dahl? All right, in fact, we will do our first public comment. If you would like to speak to the board, you should come forward to the lectern, give your name and address, and you have 5 minutes to speak. Who would like to come forward first? Anyone?
I'm Curtis Putnam. My address is 16408 James Madison Highway. I'm in the Columbia District. I'd just like to speak to this resolution about Israel. I think it's none of our business, that we should stay completely out of it and leave it just as it is. And another thing, I'm a little confused on the renovation for the county attorney's office. Now, if the proposal is to renovate the old registrar's building, that building is in no shape to be an office, basically. The floor has fallen out of it. Of course, I've only known it for about 8 years ago, but it was riddled with powder post beetles at the time, and the floor joists all need to be replaced. So it's probably not going to be $200,000. It's probably going to be more like $1 million or $500,000. And that old registrar's building should be pushed down and put something decent in its place that has enough room for an office. There's no real room in that building for an office. As far as the present county attorney's office, yes, it does need upgrades, and that's all. But as far as upgrading that other building, I would say no, not do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Putnam. Anyone else would like to address the board? Yes.
Sorry, I just want to make sure you guys were settled. Apologies for being late. My name is James Kelly. I live at 363 Manor Boulevard in Palmyra, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today, yet again, as it relates to carryover requests. I know that it is on the agenda today to be dispatched with. And so from a school perspective, we have a number of items on the CIP. I know that I've articulated this a couple of times before, but just as a rehash, the schools have two tracks, the middle and the high school, which are in pretty bad shape, the middle school being incredibly bad shape. The turf field at the high school, the bathrooms at Central Elementary, and then also our kind of routine bus replacement schedule. And so the school system returned to the Board of Supervisors about $500,000 this year. And so our board requested that you would include a population study for $30,000, which will help us predict the fluctuations in student population, ensure we know how many students we're going to receive over the next couple of years. And then secondarily, we would ask that you emphasize and or fund the bathroom renovations at Central Elementary. This is one of several 500,000 plus items on the CIP. We seem to have a considerable amount kind of stacked up. That's unfortunate, and hopefully we'll be able to smooth this over the next couple of years here. But I hope that you're inclined and will support using the carryover funds from the school to help the schools knock off some of those items in the CIP. And I know that I just saw Dr. Stribling and Dr. Gretz here as well. And so if you have any questions about any of those items or about our budget or anything, I'm confident that we are an open book and happy to answer those as well. So thank you all so much.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to speak?
Good evening, Sam Richardson, 41 Lafayette at the Lake. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the Israel resolution, which I want to thank the board for taking into consideration, for discussing it, and for placing it on the agenda tonight. I am grateful to you. And I'd also like just to remind everybody that this board has in the past covered matters of national and international import, because we are people who like to take responsibility for our community and for our country, and not simply be pawns, but persons who have agency and who are able to take a role, as our founders wanted us to do when they put our country into place, was to actually have speech and to have agency in our country. And I want to commend for, I want to speak to the resolution as it is currently written. Point number one, what happened on October 7th, that is wonderful. I have no problem with that whatsoever. However, looking through other items, the residents of the Gaza Strip are not Israel's enemies. Well, it's not a clear fact. Some of the residents are not Israel's enemies. Some of the residents actually are. We have very troublesome data that's not collected with good methodology. As a sociologist, I can guarantee you that the data collected is not using good methodology, and so we really don't know what proportion of the Gaza population is in favor of Hamas as a governmental organization, in favor of Hamas as a terrorist organization, would rather be under Israeli law and security, or would rather do something else. We really don't know. So to state this as a fact is difficult. The fourth point, encourage the support and efforts of global leadership. This is an ambiguous term. I'm guessing the UN, not a friend of Israel. The United States, hopefully we continue to be a friend of Israel. Iran, not a friend of Israel. The OPEC countries, it depends. It's in a state of flux. I do trust Saudi Arabia more than I trusted them 10 years ago, but this is another statement. It needs to be tightened up. And what do we mean by global leadership? I would actually say that we support and encourage the efforts of the Israeli people to do what is best in their interests. I'm also concerned about the fifth point where it says we're concerned about escalating violence. Absolutely. And the impacts of the terror attack on innocent civilians, that actually could be taken as an anti-Israel statement because, of course, many people have made a moral equivalence of Israel's defense of itself with Hamas's terrorist attack. I know logically it is inferencing how the Israelis were attacked by Hamas, but it could be read differently by people who want to read it differently. And then the sixth and the seventh, okay, again, I'd like to tighten it up a little bit, but I'm fine with those. On the resolution, specifically, number three, I would like to point out that there is only one Jewish state in the entire world, which makes up less than 0.011 of the land mass of the entire globe, versus, depending upon how you count, there's a minimum of 17 Arab states that comprise well over 20% of the globe. And I would like to, it would be great if that could be pointed out. I'm also concerned about stating, yes, we are against both anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim sentiment. However, anti-Muslim sentiment in this country has not increased over the past 8.5 weeks. Anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, anti-Israeli sentiment has increased well over 200%. And we have good data to demonstrate that. And so again, I don't want to conflate data. I don't want to confuse the topic. I'd like the board to come back with a updated resolution that is clear. And I would draw your attention to House Resolution 888 from the U.S. House of Representatives passed last week with overwhelming bipartisan support as a possible model, which speaks of the native issue of Israel to the land, of the people of Israel to the land of Israel, of the historic persecution of Jewish diaspora communities, which is why Israel is so important, because we're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism around the world, and that overall reject specifically calls for Israeli destruction. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to speak to the board? If not, I will close the first comment section and come back to the board. We do not have a public hearing this afternoon, so we'll go to action matters. A resolution supporting Israel, condemning terrorism, and protecting human rights. So we're going to read the resolution.
Yeah, just one thing I just wanted to just bring up ahead of time. So there is some comments that were sent to the board regarding the board's policy. about resolutions. And so if you look at policy 1.6 under resolutions, so under screen 1.6.2 under policy intent, there's a line that looks at the third sentence in there. It says resolutions ordinarily relate to the administrative and operational aspects of county government, and there's some other things. If you go under B, it says resolutions are generally used for two purposes. First, resolutions express their consensus on matters of public policy. Lawmakers routinely deliver criticism or support on a broad range of social issues, legal rights, court opinions, and even decisions by higher governmental authorities. Second, resolutions are used for internal administrative purposes. So I know there was some discussion on whether or not doing a resolution like this or others like this falls within the county's policy. Speaking with Mr. Witten and I had a conversation looking at the intent and the language in the policy. We feel that these resolutions or resolutions of this nature do meet the county's policy intent. And Mr. Witten, do you have any?
No, that's correct. Looking at the policy, it meets the intent of the policy. It's similar to the George Floyd resolution the board passed several years ago. So it fall under that same section of the policy.
So I just wanted to bring that piece up, because I know there were some comments about it. Does this follow the policy or not? And then the resolution, I know Mr. Richardson, let's pull it up. So there's the resolution before you. And so it was in the board package, so I'm not sure if...
Do board members, do you want me to read this resolution?
Sure.
I'll give it.
Before someone has to read it.
I've read it a number of times, but...
Yeah.
For the public.
For the public. Okay. All right. Whereas on October 7, 2023, during the Jewish holiday of Simanina Duret, Hamas, an organization deemed a terrorist organization by the United States and other countries, launched a coordinated attack on Israel, resulting in the kidnapping and slaughter of unarmed civilians, and whereas the ensuing conflict has caused immense suffering, loss of innocent lives, and has inflicted widespread damage on a peaceful civilian population. And whereas the residents of the Gaza Strip and not Israel's enemies, with many such residents opposing Hamas terrorist actions, and whereas we encourage and support the efforts of global leadership to reduce harm to uninvolved civilians, and whereas we are deeply concerned about the escalated violence, loss of life, and the impact of this terror attack on innocent civilians, and whereas it is essential for local communities to stand together against acts of terrorism and express solidarity with these affected by such atrocities. And whereas the county of Fluvanna stands firmly against any form of terrorism, violence, and extremism that undermines the principles of coexistence, peace, and human dignity. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors, number one, stands in solidarity with the right of the State of Israel as a sovereign nation to defend itself and its residents against the despicable acts of Hamas and aligned terrorist groups. Number two, stands in solidarity with the right of all people to live in peace and security. Number three, stands in solidarity with the Jewish and Muslim communities and strongly condemn all anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim sentiment and actions. The following resolution was duly and regularly adopted in the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors at the meeting of the board held on the 6th day of December I don't know if I can say it's adopted yet. So we are going to take it back to the board now for discussion, and we do have a motion.
So do you want me to leave the resolution up right now, or do you want me to go to the motion?
No, just leave it up.
You can leave it up, yeah. Discussion?
So I think when Sam, Mr. Richardson, first brought this to the board, it was, you know, fresh on sort of the heels of the attack. And he had also come in front of the board and expressed the rise in anti-Semitism that he was experiencing, his community, the community here in the area was experiencing. And, you know, spoke passionately, I don't want to put words in his mouth, of, you know, how some in his community were in fear, essentially. I think it's very difficult for the board in a situation like this, when we're asked by a resident representing a group of people that are part of our community, to take on a resolution like this. But I think it's also important. And the board spent probably a good hour in discussion reviewing the resolution as presented by Mr. Richardson, and then also, you know, our own comments and thoughts and concerns with the resolution, because we do understand that there are, you know, a number of complicated geopolitical issues and forces behind this. And so to some degree, we maybe took an effort to take language that might have been worded strongly in a particular fashion and maybe softened it down, as Mr. Richardson pointed out. And I think that was intentional on the board's part to be able to find consensus, because this is really complicated, and I think a lot of people feel really disturbed by some of the effects of the war that is currently happening in the Gaza Strip and displacement. Today, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary for the United Nations, enacted Article 99, which is essentially a call for the Security Council to get together because of his concerns about the displacement of the Gaza Strip and the security crisis it could create. These are things that stand outside of our community, for sure. But I think we kind of, at least in our discussion, while we weren't 100% certain that we were all there together, we could all agree that we thought that anti-Semitism, hatred, Muslim, anti-Muslim sentiment, there have been some instances that are relatively fresh. I don't know for a fact that the three young men that were shot were Muslims or not, but they were certainly shot because they were wearing Palestinian headscarves. When we see that kind of stuff happening in our community, in our country, I think we all find it very disturbing. I personally voted for the resolution that the board passed for George Floyd, and you know, I felt that that was the right vote at that point in time to stand against racism and police violence, and to encourage changes in policies in terms of how people are handled by the police. And again, that was challenging and difficult. Several of us were in front of the board when a resolution was put forward with regard to Second Amendment concerns that happened when the legislative body turned Democratic a couple of years ago. And there was a lot of concern about Second Amendment rights being taken away. Again, really complicated issues. But this was a conversation that we had, and so, you know, I know that there are a lot of people that may be here that didn't speak about it, don't know where they stand. I know that we received a lot of letters asking us either to support or not to support it. And each of us will make our vote based on kind of where we have tried to analyze and interpret all this. But I know that collectively, the real message that we're trying to send here is that, you know, we want to promote a solution in peace, and that certainly we can all recognize that terrorism is the worst way to enact that policy. So that's all I have to say. Think about it.
Thank you. Any other comment?
Well, I think it's notable that the House made a resolution, and if I can, I'll try to read through it quickly because it goes a bit to how I think we should react from here. Resolution 888, whereas the Jewish people are native to the land of Israel, whereas throughout history and across the reign of multiple kingdoms, the Jewish people were persecuted and expelled from the land of Israel, forced to live as minority diaspora communities in other lands. Whereas Jewish diaspora communities were historically violently persecuted in, and in some cases expelled from, other countries throughout the Middle East, Europe, Africa, and Asia due to their religion. Whereas the Nazis attempted to annihilate the entire Jewish population of Europe during the Holocaust, murdering 6 million Jews during this time. Whereas this genocide provided new urgency to reestablish a Jewish homeland for the Jewish people following the Holocaust, where they would not be a vulnerable minority, where they could freely practice their faith, and where something like the Holocaust can never happen again. Whereas the modern state of Israel was established on May 14, 1948, whereas even after the establishment of the state of Israel, other countries and terrorist entities continued to attack Israel, reject its right to exist, and call for its destruction, and whereas Israel is the only Jewish state, and therefore, despite persistent external threats, the existence of Israel provides Jews a place to live free from persecution and discrimination. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the House of Representatives reaffirms the state of Israel's right to exist, recognizes that denying Israel's right to exist is a form of anti-Semitism, rejects calls for Israel's destruction and elimination of the only Jewish state, and condemns the Hamas-led terrorist attacks on Israel. That's a very notable event that's happened since we last met. And my thought is that given some of the concerns that were expressed over our current resolution, some of what's in the House's resolution, and the fact that Mrs. Eager was unable to attend due to health reasons, I would make a motion that we defer her follow-up to the next meeting, give us a chance to look a little more, given the House's resolution, at what our resolution says and looks like, and again, give Mrs. Eager a chance to participate in something that seemed to be important to her as her term comes to an end.
Thank you, Craig. Ms. Earn, do you?
Well, there's a motion. Wait, is there a second? Did you make a motion?
No.
I did make a motion, but I can.
Okay.
Well,
if Mike wants to speak,
yeah.
I can.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. I want to withdraw your motion.
Right. I can withdraw the motion.
All right. This is something I've struggled with because we're getting. Yeah, this is something I've struggled with. I'll just talk about her. First happened, like any other human being. What happened is awful. All I can think about is 9/11. Terrorism, I don't know if we'll ever get rid of it, but we got to do everything we can to stop it. And let them know that, you know, we're not afraid of it. I know I'm going to butcher how I say this. And as far as children go, there's not a human being alive. Well, I can't say that because there's some that just don't care about children. But I've spent my life serving children and trying to protect them and making a statement saying that we, innocent lives being lost is awful. There's no way, no matter which side they're on, anytime you lose innocent lives, and to target innocent lives is awful, for lack of better words. And to hide behind innocent children. So, I mean, hearing some of the statements that were made, I could put this off. But, you know, I don't know if you're ever going to say something that's right. And I said this when we did the Second Amendment. I said this when we did George Floyd. We're kind of getting outside of our boundaries, but it was just a statement to be made that we're not putting up with stuff like that. It's the best way I can put it. The word politically correct, I think, are the worst two words that ever hit our country. We need to go back to right and wrong. Period. So anyway, I stopped talking longer than I wanted to.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's awful. I get aggravated when I just think about it.
Yes. I do too. I mean, it has been a struggle. I've read other resolutions. I looked at other ways people have said this. I've said it in the news. I've cried. My feelings is not totally in this resolution. I feel that we ought to try to work. We're never going to, it probably never satisfy everyone, but we need to work to get something that is satisfactory to us, that we can feel good about making that motion and standing behind those words and those thoughts. So I would like for you to put the motion up, and then Chris, you do what you already suggested. You change some words.
I would simply mention that Mrs. Eager may or may not be here next time. Mr. Sheridan won't be here next time.
Yeah.
Oh,
and that will be our last
true.
Board meeting
yeah.
with this current board.
I forgot about Mike not being here.
So I'm not certain that we'll ever find, as has been pointed out already, the right words. I think the most important thing, regardless as to whether this resolution succeeds or fails or is deferred, is that it's a conversation. And I would have hoped to hear from other folks as well to hear their ideas aside from the letters that we received. But certainly, and I think Mr. Richardson's intention was at least to open the dialogue and the conversation behind this. I'll leave it at that.
I'll say one thing. I wasn't going to get too carried away with this. A young man played for me the first year I took over as a head coach. And as soon as he graduated, he joined the Army. And he later on became a Ranger. And he came back one day and came out to practice and asked me to come kick shag fly balls. I said, with what you're willing to do for me, yeah, if they want to fire me for that, they can fire me. They can have my job. Sorry, Superintendent. But I asked him while we were out there, I said, with what you see on the news today, you have no idea what to believe when you live in Kenstore. I said, should we be over there? And this was a 20-year-old young man whose life was on the line. And he looked at me and he did said, Coach, if we're not over there, the good people don't stand a chance. He didn't say the good Israeli people. He didn't say the good Arabic people. He just said the good people. He said, we're the only thing that stands between them and somebody else with a gun. And that put it about as simply as you could put it. So anyway, that was a young man who knew at any time he could lose his life.
So it sounds like maybe we're saying we do want to
deal
with it tonight. I'll elaborate a little bit. I was in early 2020, right before COVID hit, I was in Israel. And as a Christian and somebody who's able to see the Holy Land and put some of what I've only read about or heard about into vision and
and then toured the Holocaust Museum, which of course there's none like this one. And then also had the, in some ways, the luxury of not having to think as much about it because it had been somewhat resolved for to this extent for, you know, a long time, and then I wouldn't have even have imagined that a couple years later that these acts would have happened that have rekindled this all-out war. And so it's hard for me to have been there to, and, you know, I saw somebody said something recently about that a person's religion shouldn't be part of what they consider when they're on the board. And good Lord, what Christian, Buddhist, Muslim that's involved in government doesn't pray about the decisions they make? That would just, it's just nonsensical. And to me, it is the Holy Land. And when you think of, I mean, there's no arguing that people tried to eliminate the Jews from the face of the earth. And what happened the other night, or the other night, in October was an act of terrorism against just citizens and youth and women who are still being held hostage. And I am one who tends to think that we do too many resolutions. But in the scope of all of this that's going on, in the scope of how some organizations in America have responded to it, I do believe there needs to be a voice supporting Israel and speaking against terrorism. And so I will make a motion that we support this resolution. I move the Flagana County Board of Supervisors adopt a resolution entitled A Resolution Supporting Israel, Condemning Terrorism, and Protecting Human Rights.
Do you have a second? Any more discussion?
Let's hope for peace.
Amen.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? I vote aye.
Can I make a... I can't make a comment now, can I?
If you would like to.
I just want to say, you know, a board member from another county recently, over the last year, said to me, a conversation we're having, Chris, we weren't elected for the easy stuff. And this is one that's really been a struggle to figure out where and our position is, what our voice should be, and so on. And knowing that there's people on both sides of it and wanting to support citizens who believe in different ways, this didn't come easy today. Thank you.
Okay, and I do want to remind people here this afternoon that you've heard a lot of discussion and the conversation of fear and struggling with this resolution. We do have a second comment time. You may want to come forward at that time and speak before you leave this afternoon. Thank you. Now we will go on to B, which is the RISE Project BATI update and letter of support. Yes.
Good evening. I think you have Galen's name on
Galen.
Your presenter,
yeah,
and I'm going to let Galen talk in a minute. First of all, thanks for giving us an opportunity to come in and give you a little update.
And tell us who you are.
Yes, ma'am. I'm Gary Wood.
Yes,
I'm the
yes.
President and CEO of Central Virginia Electric Co-op and Firefly Fiber Broadband, And Galen Creekmore is with me, who is with both companies as well. And y'all have had a difficult conversation and some pretty heavy topics to start the meeting. I'm hoping to give you some good news to lighten just a little bit as we talk a little bit about Firefly and about broadband access in Pludina County. Can I get the next slide? This slide just shows the areas where we have coverage in blue that's active today. We also have partnered with the county, and in this salmon or pink colored area is where we're still working with some funds through the Virginia Telecommunications Initiative award of 2022. We have completed some of that area around Teepee Town and Bremo Bluff, but we still have the largest part of the southern piece of the county that we'll cover will be part of a Dominion middle mile build out. They have been actively working to design that and plan to build it next year, and we will connect people off of that Dominion middle mile, we'll lease it from Dominion, and we'll extend it further out. So that's kind of a quick look, and I'm going to go to another slide in a minute, but while this is up, a couple of things are interesting. I looked at some statistics today, and I looked at it partly because we're going to have a little bit of board changeover, and to kind of think about what's happened since we started this in 2019, we really started construction. And we partnered with Pludina County and agreed to put our headquarters here. This was one of the earliest places we started work. According to the FCC broadband map data, as reported through June 30th of this year, broadband access is available at 94.6% of homes in Pludina County. 94.6% of all homes that the FCC recognizes in Pludina County have broadband access at 100, at least 100 megabit per second download and 20 megabit per second upload, 94.6. I took a quick look at Loudoun County, which is the home of the internet with all the data centers. They have 95.1% of their folks have access. So you're pretty good company. The second thing is, of the access that's available in Pludina County, 89% have access to gigabit speed service because the fiber is everywhere. In Loudoun County, 1% has access to gigabits. So you've made a leap, and it's happened in 4 years. It's been pretty incredible. Still some work to do. We're going to be working down that southern end. And the next slide, we show the same schedule that we show online, which the one thing, we haven't put a date up for the work in the southern end of the county because we're waiting to get a little bit more firm idea of when Dominion will finish their piece. I'm guessing it'll be probably the second half and most likely even the fourth quarter of next year, but until we know exactly when Dominion will have that done, we can't really put a firm date up. But we'll work as quickly as we can. Tonight, I really want to ask for you to join us as a partner and ask for your support for another round of BODi applications. The good news is there's not much left to be done. So on the next slide, we looked for BODi 2024 to find every remaining location that was in the FCC database as being unserved today. I will say that a couple of the providers have, in the last 6 months, been a little more forthcoming or honest about what they can serve and can't serve, so there's a few left. But it's really very few. And you'll see the little red dots, and each one of those red dots is an individual home that is in an area that may otherwise have service all around it, but that home or business doesn't have service. And we're collecting those in one more project. We're doing this across the 11 counties, and a lot of counties have a lot more than this. On the next slide is a little bit of a close-up to show a little more. On the left-hand side, you can see this is the area just south of the village of Palmyra. And between Route 15 and the river, there are a few homes that are ways off of the road. There's Comcast along the road there. They probably had either some really high estimates what it'll take to build to them, or Comcast may not build to them. So they're in the database without anyone claiming that there's service available. We're picking those up. So we're looking at picking up all the locations like that. There are a few in Fork Union. There are a few spread out in a couple of areas that otherwise have service around them. On the right, you can see we've turned on a different layer on our maps that have the little green dots. That shows the homes that do have service available. So you can see that the red unserved ones are kind of interspersed. So we'll be building past some folks who have service to get to the ones who are unserved as part of this project. With that, I'm going to let Galen take over and talk about some numbers and then what you can do to support us.
Thanks, Gary. Great to be with the board this evening. Again, I'm Galen Creekmore. On the next slide, we'll dive into some numbers on what it actually will take to fill in these holes to get to that rest of that, say, 5% of the county that's unserved. Our total passings will be about 150 passings. Those are unserved qualifying passings for the grant. As Gary mentioned, we will pass other homes throughout the build-out, but these are 150 passings, and we'll include within the next round of ADDIE. It will only take about 4 miles of additional fiber to build out to these homes because these are areas where it either takes service drops or small lateral extensions off of the main line that we're already gonna have in the area. As I say, when you cover 95% of the county, there's a good chance we're gonna have fiber nearby to fill in these pockets. It'll take us about $250,000 to fill in these holes, and with the way prices are rising on everything, it may tick up a little bit by the end of that 18-month build-out project. The best number of all that I can show any board on any slide is that we're asking for a $0 local match from the county. We appreciate the county support, and due to the nature of the small build-out that we'll have to fill in these pockets, we would only ask for a letter of support that's before you tonight that we can send in with the application. So on the next slide, we'll talk briefly about next steps. We hope it may be the pleasure of the board to join the project and the application this year by passing the resolution of support that's before you tonight. I also want to talk briefly about what the timeline looks like. December 19th is when the VADI application will be due. It'll go through a challenge period after that. And then the state has given us a rough timeline of spring of the year, targeting an April timeline for announcement for awards. We'll go through a contract negotiation period after that. So we're probably looking at a mid-summer type timeline for if we have a successful award and contracts are signed of being able to begin construction. So look for that second half of 2024 to have construction in this area. The good news for Fluvanna is when we begin construction, it'll be a relatively short construction period since, again, we're talking about mostly drops and laterals off of existing fiber that we're gonna have in the area. And on the next slide, I believe I have a short, yes. A brief image on our website. I know as supervisors, you always get questions from citizens, especially in those Dominion Power areas, perhaps, or areas where we're planning to go next. In fact, I got one from your county administrator just this past week that, of course, if we cover 95% of the county, we're going to get a few questions from that last 5%. And you can always direct those folks to our website. We have a web page specifically designed for Fluvanna County that has project trackers on each of those projects, and all of the maps that we've shared tonight are on our website. So with that, we can answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? So let me make one quick point. The 147 match up pretty close. By our estimation, you got about 12,500 total serviceable locations in the county. This is really the last 1%. This gets you to 100. So that's what we're really asking. Just for you to support us as we go, we're going to ask for some state grant funds to help offset it a little bit. That's it.
I got one question. I got one gentleman that wears me out. He lives going down the hill in Bremer, right in the town. He's like, I can see the black lines hanging on the pole a couple hundred yards from my house. And that's going to be, so I can tell him to look here, but I can give him June of 24 or end of 24.
I feel comfortable that we're going to get to it in the second half of 24. But we aren't quite ready to post that date for certain until Dominion can give us a certain date.
But I can tell him not to expect anybody because I had told him, I thought we had said something about mid-24. But it won't start until mid-24.
Right. So Dominion filed they have to get approval from the State Corporation Commission because of the way their piece of it's regulated. And they will not hear from the State Corporation Commission until probably March or April themselves. And they can't lease to us until they get that. So they're still doing some construction, but I would lean toward the second half, and I'd rather surprise people by being there sooner.
Okay, I always have my famous question. What about their families that can't afford to book on? Are you going to have any help for those families in the future?
Well, we accept the Affordable Connectivity Program from the federal government, okay, which provides up to $30 a month as support. Mm-hmm. And with our $50 cheapest package, that does more than most families need. That leaves about $20. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything yet to offset that further. But we will try to put people in contact with other organizations and folks who can try to help. Okay. And we do maintain some public Wi-Fi locations in the county and in various areas to try to help.
Right. That's good for the school to know, too, to keep up with y'all and share with the children. All right, thank you.
I have one question, one comment. Mm-hmm. Question is, how many people are employed at Savannah now by Firefly?
Well, Firefly has 35 total employees in Fluvanna County. It's a little hard because nowadays employment and who shows up at offices looks different. But we have all of our CSRs, there are 8 of those. We've got our network engineering staff is 4. We've got a couple of installers, 2 or 3. We've got a couple of line techs. We've got some managers. So I'm guessing we're somewhere 15 to 20 that would tell you they report to the office in Fluvanna when they report to the office.
The second comment is for the public. Mr. Wood presented to a group of supervisors in a meeting, I think in 2020, mm-hmm. If I recall correctly. It was sort of the annual meeting where all the local supervisors get together. And at that point in time, he had just convinced the board of CVEC to invest $100 million into broadband for the purposes of serving CVEC's network, and was inviting counties to join in by participating and sharing some costs with them. Nelson County was already in the process of doing that, and I think CVEC had acquired, as one of the first acquisitions for Firefly, the broadband authority of Nelson County at that point in time, or was in the process of doing it. He mentioned at that point in time that the state of Virginia was spending, correct me if I'm wrong, somewhere between the neighborhood of $9 to $11 million a year was allocated in funds for all of Virginia.
It was actually in 2019, it was $1 million.
So the vision that he had and what he wanted to bring to Central Virginia was really remarkable, and the investment and the courage of the board of directors at Central Virginia Electric was also really wonderful. Of course, then COVID happened, and his $100 million became a little bit more palatable, and remarkable growth. I think you've gone over 10,000 plus subscribers, not 15,000 now. How many?
25,000 as of the week of Thanksgiving.
25,000, it just happens like that in the course of 4 years. So really a remarkable service to the Central Virginia community. I just want to commend you and your staff and your vision and your leadership.
Thank you, and thanks again for the partnership with Fluvanna. It's just been It's been great to have county partners who have entrusted us, because we've been driving around in people's backyards now for 4 years, and up and down the highways and working in the roadways sometimes, and the community's embraced it, and so we appreciate it.
And I will say that Pulgata County was the second partner to sign the Happy Nelson County.
I'll start with a question. Roughly 50% of our population is around what I call the Lake Monticello Beltway. So you've got Lake Monticello, then the subdivisions that are similar, like Aqua, are tapping into that infrastructure. I would imagine the ability to get to such a high percentage comparable to Loudoun and others in a fairly quick manner had to do with Lake Monticello, didn't it? That roughly 50% of our population is in such a small pocket of our square miles?
Well, it has more to do with the amount of overlap that Central Virginia had throughout the county. Nelson County's at 98%, and it doesn't have high density, except for a little bit around Wintergreen, but it's not nearly as much density as here. But our footprint at the electric co-op overlapped a larger part of Fluvanna and Nelson. So when we did our build out, we caught up a lot. And then since then, we've built outside of there and picked up like the rest of the lake and some of the other areas. And the CARES project that we did that came down 15 a little further. So there have been a couple of things that moved it a little further, but certainly that density helps.
And thank you. Just a comment. To every single person I met in the field with Firefly, I couldn't have asked for them to be more professional in how they dealt with the customer, them being accommodating, everything was yes sir, no sir. So it was pretty impressive to see that you all were able to do that in the field to that extent.
I appreciate that comment, and we worked really hard to remind every person who comes onto our project that Central Virginia Electric started with really happy members. And when we finish this project, we want to finish with really happy members. And all the new folks outside that we're touching, the new subscribers, we want to treat the same way. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All
right. Next we'll go to C.
No, ma'am, we got to do the motion. I move the Board of Supervisors to adopt the resolution entitled a resolution of support for the award of the Firefly TJPDC VADI 2024 grant application.
Second.
All right. Motion by Ms. Church and second by Ms. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye and just one absent. Okay, now we will go to C. Advertise for public hearing to enact section 4-2-5 of the county code to prohibit dogs from running off the beach and carrying out property, and we will hear from our county administrator, Mr.
Yes, I'll speak first if there's any questions. Mr. Spencer's here as well. So this is, we did a presentation at the board meeting last month where we talked about the issue of dogs running off leash at Pleasant Grove Park, where they've had a number of complaints from visitors on the trails. You know, a lot of the trails there are fairly narrow if you've ever walked them or biked them or run them, and so it is a narrow pathway when you call upon a dog that is not on leash. We've also got complaints at the soccer fields there and other ball fields there where children are practicing and playing about dogs on the fields. So currently, our policy is that dogs must be on a leash at all times, except in the designated off-leash areas. And next slide. And if you look at this current designated areas, it's really just the ball fields and the horse trailer parking area. And there are signs posted on the ball fields, but there still has been an issue of dogs running onto the ball fields and soccer fields. And also the dog park in the Sandy Beach area is currently off leash as well. So basically it's to the right of the red line, all of those trails, it's off leash, which is kind of hard for the public to see the differentiation between the trails, which ones are off leash, which ones are on leash, just because Heritage Trail is on leash and off leash, and then Brush Harbor as well, it's kind of split there. Next slide. So basically, under our current policy, we're unable to enforce dogs off-leash except to charge them with trespassing, which is a Class 1 misdemeanor and is a jailable offense. So there was a proposal to draft an ordinance where there would be possible civil penalties. And so the proposed map would be the off-leash area would be over near the dog park in the Sandy Beach area. And there's also 3 miles of trails there, including the Heritage Trail and a part of Rock Brook Trail. And then Horseshoe Trail comes up the hill. And so there are 3 miles of trails where the dogs could be off-leash, as well as there's an exercise area going down the hill to the river and then the fence den dog park. Slide. The other area we discussed at the last meeting was the entrance to Pleasant Grove, the front field there where you see people park their vehicles and they'll play fetch or frisbee with their dog or fly kites there in that front field. We talked about that being also an off-leash area. Next slide. There's a picture there of that designated area. There's a drainage swale in that open field where the grass is a little higher, and that'd be there's a little parking lot over to the left for people to park. So basically, the language in the proposed ordinance, no dog shall run unrestricted as defined in this section on county properties. Unrestricted means that the dog is not on a leash, cord, chain, or enclosure. So that can be a short 6-foot leash or a flexi leash that extends. An electronic device does not qualify as a leash. So any person who is the owner or custodian of the dog can be found in violation of this section. And the dog can be impounded if the owner is not immediately found and would be subject to a civil penalty as well. So there are exemptions for service dogs servicing a disability, they can't be on a leash or harness. Also, for law enforcement dogs and dogs have been county designated off-leash trails, dog parks, and exercise areas, and that would be designated by resolution of the board. Also, any county approved events, if there was agility training or dog obedience classes at Pleasant Grove, for instance. So the penalty is similar to the running at large ordinance, where once you have 3 or more violations within 2 years, it may result in a civil penalty of $50. So question has arisen, what's the difference between running a large ordinance and the leash law ordinance? So running a large, your dog has to be under your control. So my dog could be over there in the corner, but if I have control of him, he comes right back to me. The dog is not running a large, not control. Where a leash, your dog actually has to physically be attached to a leash. So that's the leash law and a running a large ordinance. Next slide. So the ordinance would be effective 30 days after adoption to get time for the public to be aware of it through newspaper, social media, the website, let people know that, and also signage that we posted on county properties.
Okay, any questions?
Any questions?
I'll just make the comment that I'm dismayed that we have to keep putting policies like this in place, because having grown up here, you let your dogs, it wasn't so stringent about you needing to have your dogs under control, but I've also learned that with residential growth, the need becomes greater and greater to keep control over dogs, so it's something we need to have.
Okay, anyone else? We have a motion.
There is a motion.
Mm-hmm. There's a motion on the screen. Someone please.
I move that the Board of Supervisors advertise the amendments to the County Code to enact Section 4-2-5 for a public hearing to be held January
17, 2024. All right, we have a second. Second. Okay, motion by Ms. Fairchild, second by Mr. Wright. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. 1 absent. Now we're at D, Tourist Strategic Plan, Revised 2023. Jennifer Schmeck, Director of Economic Development, and Aaron Spitzer, Director of Parks and Recreation.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So we'd like to recognize a couple of our NTAC members that are in the audience tonight. I didn't catch everybody in here. But I know Susie Morris is here, Nina Monroe, Trisha Johnson, Peggy Shanklin.
Excuse me.
Can you hear me?
I'd like to say happy birthday to the young lady.
To Susie.
Ms. Morris. I'm sorry, I saw your son post this morning.
Happy birthday.
So the EdTAC Committee, the Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Committee, they put in place back in February 2018 the first tourism strategic plan, and it expired in 2020. So COVID happened, staff changing happened, so they decided to put the strategic plan revision on pause until we got the economic development strategic plan in place so that both of these plans can, you know, complement each other. So February 2023, we picked it up, the Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Committee, EdTAC, reviewed and discussed the 2018 plan, and they decided, you know what, it's a great plan, let's just update it, let's revise it. So we bring to you today the newly revised plan that the EdTAC voted on in November 2023. It doesn't have a lot of significant changes in the executive summary and the SWOT analysis, just a lot of cleanup, some, you know, some punctuation and things. And then they updated the vision statement, which I'll go over in a minute. And then the goals. So they checked off the completed tasks, add some new ones, and updated the language a little bit.
All right, good evening. So I get the strategic plan vision statement. So the proposed vision statement will be Fluvanna County will be recognized as a travel and retreat destination that welcomes tourists through scenic gateways to a place that maintains a small town charm, unique heritage, rich history, and natural beauty. So the only things that were changed kind of on the old vision statement were underlined. It goes to gateway, it mentions the gateways in the community now, and we added rich history. Which are the two main differences in the vision statement. And the next slide, so goal one is under the strategic goals. It's to build upon successful tourism marketing strategies and branding. So what this means, like the logo, the rat card, and video. So this is to enhance the county's brand as an acceptable adventure and event destination, which we are trying to do. We're trying to bring people into our community to come and do stuff. And also to identify and secure funding for materials and programs to be used in specific marketing and outreach. And I think we've been doing that through some grants and other kind of ways to try to get things into the community. The next one would be goal two. So goal two is to evaluate needs of tourism infrastructure opportunities by focus areas, which is outdoor recreation, arts, history, black history and culture, and agribusiness. So what this kind of means is to design consistent signage at gateways in the county. And I think we've kind of already started doing that with the green entry signs in the different places in the community. Research B&B ordinance updates and pursue changes if needed. And I think that's something that the board hears quite often. So that's why that was left in there. Complete broadband in the county. It sounds like Firefly's done a good job trying to get that done quick. And update the county website with tourism and dedicated webpage. And that's being done through hashtag Find Fluvanna. So we are kind of, we've already in the process of a lot of these, looks like in goal two. So hopefully we can get those done by 2025, I think. When we'll revisit. And then I'm gonna let her do the other three. Or two.
So goal three. Goal three is Goal three is to increase the capacity of businesses and tourism activities in Fluvanna County. And so we're going to do that specifically by conducting organizational review of similar organizations. Then we're going to perform an analysis of staff time, personnel cost, advertising. This is really to get that data together for grant opportunities. we're going to, well, this has already happened, so, but we're going to earmark a portion of the lodging tax collected for to offset tourism expenses. We're going to research additional grant opportunities, and we're going to leverage local and regional community and governmental partnerships. Goal four, we're going to increase opportunities for current and potential tourism small business in the county through more effective and broader communication and awareness programs, or awareness campaigns. So we're going to provide training for businesses to learn how to master social media. So we're starting to do that, partnering with the SBDC and so forth, to really get them to understand the marketing. We're going to encourage the use of the community calendar. We also have one on Find Fluvanna, the new website. Create a new tourism newsletter, and we're going to provide assistance to coordinate marketing and advertising within cross-themed programming. I think that's it.
Any questions?
I was looking at you have a list of, you had more in the board packet.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, so we pulled those out and actually put them on individual slides.
Yeah.
But we also have the meat of the executive summary and the SWOT analysis.
Because on page, I think it was page 10, it had an EST at the end of a statement, and I was wondering.
Page 10?
Yeah, it was kind of an awkward.
Page 10
at the bottom.
NTC.
Mm-hmm.
Et cetera.
Et cetera.
Yeah. Was it on 10?
The strong base of Black historic sites.
Right. Yeah.
Rosenwald School, slave chapels,
et cetera. What is et cetera? I mean, why et cetera is there? Can we name it? Name what it is?
I can name one.
Yeah.
The Cemetery of Columbia Bend.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
I would have to phone a friend to our historians, and actually Ms. Kilpatrick is not here, who helped us edit this.
So Ms. Johnson is
back here.
And I also saw that someplace it would just say Brimo.
Yes.
And that Brimo what? Oh, Brimo, no, Brimo what Brimo? Brimo community?
The Brimo community. So she up in the top half, it does say Brimo Plantation, but then she wanted to do Brimo. Oh, come on.
Yeah. That was a list ago. The list had just Brimo at the end.
Yes, ma'am.
And I just thought, what Brimo are they talking about? I know another place I think you said, Hollywood and Dunbar School. Am I reading the right places? Because I don't have it. Hollywood is not. Hollywood is a Rosenwald school, but Hollywood is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you mention the Rosenwald school somewhere?
Yes, ma'am.
We
it's
did.
In there.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Well, and it said,
right there. In the
PTC.
Yeah.
Rosenwald school in place.
Yeah, I know that part, but it was somewhere where it mentioned Hollywood and Dunbar. And Hollywood is the school over there on the Kent Store area that we don't. We know it's Rosenwald School.
Right there. Right there, community house in Cedar Lake.
There we go. I knew I had some. See, I don't have it printed like you did. Anyway, Hollywood and Dunbar Rosenwald School schools refurbished for touring. Hollywood has not been refurbished. I would love to see Hollywood refurbished. The only one refurbished, you've got Douglas, which is a home. It's empty now. We need to find out whether Mrs. Morris's daughter is going to do anything with that one.
Yes,
the one in Shiloh is a private home.
Mm-hmm.
The one in West Bottom burned down.
Mm-hmm.
Dunbar's refurbished, so.
You're missing an
Mountain Hill?
Lone Star is a private residence, too. Lone Star and the other Rosenwald School is a private residence.
Metallurgy
School.
Yeah, Lone Star has been a question in people's minds.
It's not mine.
Not yours. Yeah, so those were the things that I just picked up on as I read through that.
Yes, ma'am. Do I need to say who I am so people know? I'm Patricia Johnson, 317 Shannon Hill Road, Columbia District. Hi, Mr. Sharon. And director of the Fluvanna Historical Society and member of EdTech. And so it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the one that you were talking about that kind of did et cetera, I think that was 50, because there's so many Black historic sites that we're working on right now, and so many of them are kind of in the same situation that Hollywood is, where we've identified it, we see it as a potential, a possibility, but it's not something that's happening yet. So for instance, there are there's some housing for enslaved people in the West Bottom community. They were working with the property owner towards seeing if we can make that publicly accessible and then getting grant funding to restore it. We've already had it studied by the people from the Virginia Slave Housing Project. So there are a lot of places right that, like that right at New Fork School, for instance,
yeah,
the high school.
Right.
So you know where we are in that,
yeah,
because you're part of that process. You do, where do you put it in this? As a possibility, something
right.
that I can work towards?
Yes, yeah, so you don't lose it. You need, I would put it so that it's not lost.
You'd like those things to be iterated in
right.
this? We can make that happen.
Yeah. And the other thing I thought that we don't mention any plantations. There was a plantation in Fork Union, which you mentioned to me, I'd never heard of. And then the others in Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a plantation.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Jennifer, we don't, oh. So I just thought all of that is just a part of when we start touring, and maybe sometimes we'll have bus tours once a month. The one that the Fluvanna County Leadership Development does, that tour, is a wonderful tour that maybe could be put in this in the future.
Yes, we
have a possibility.
And this is just this thought came in my mind, and I apologize for it. But we have, I'm not sure how many centennial farms,
mm-hmm.
I believe bicentennial farms
mm-hmm.
should be listed.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought about that too. I wrote some down.
I think one of the problems is that kind of dividing line of what's publicly accessible,
well,
what
correct.
Is it, what is even, what's even visible from the road versus what isn't. I think there are like two different kinds of maps. I think there's a group with FLDP right now that again wants to work on some sort of mapping of historic sites in Fluvanna. Somebody several years ago wanted to do a driving tour where you would plug into, you could listen to where you were, but a lot of those places aren't publicly accessible and are not visible from the road. So it's a
yeah.
riddle, it's a bit of a conundrum.
Right.
But I trust you know, Ms. Booker, that we are working a lot on the county's Black history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important to me personally. And I agree, we need to iterate it. So I'll come up with a list that's more complete.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, yes. And then the one on Shores Road, too, Rose. Name that one, like, right on the end of Shores Road, right in. The Methodist Church.
There's another Rosenwald School.
No, not Rosenwald. It's where Ellen.
Melrose.
Melrose.
Yes, ma'am.
Is
going
that
out there Friday.
Oh, okay.
I will say where you were talking about Brimo. I think that's under opportunities, and I think we're talking about the Brimo community itself.
Mm-hmm.
So not just Brimo Bluff, but not to get on my soapbox, I'm going to be super brief, but many of the communities surrounding Brimo and the other James River plantations are made up of descendants of people who were enslaved on those plantations. So we're talking about recognizing that and looking at the early actions of people right after emancipation and how these communities grew.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank
so
you.
We'll have more specificity on that point.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Anything else?
And when is the next work day going to be?
That's up to the church.
Okay. All right.
It'll be this winter because we're not going to fight the Yellow Jackets again.
That's pretty funny watching Coach Face Young.
I'm going to tell him you said that.
Yeah.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all for the update.
Are there any other questions? So we'll make these changes. We'll make sure we make the changes. And we'll put Brimo community instead of just Brimo.
Yeah.
And that way they'll know it's all the community, if that makes sense.
All right, I appreciate it.
I've got just a quick question. So some of this is just market driven. So, for example, specialty shops, hardware stores, boutique style businesses, and so on. So one, I'm not sure what government could do to help create more of that. So I guess we'll start with that. Any thoughts of?
So that's where the economic development side of this comes in, and we really, you know, work on fostering and growing the entrepreneurial spirit in Savannah. And that's really to grow our business base, right? So we can get all the tourists here for the history sites, but we need them to spend their money here. So we do need to work on focusing on the business support industry. So that's where we would assist.
We want them to come here and then send them somewhere when they get here. So we like to send them to business in the community.
I agree, but I just mean, so I've always wondered what role government can play. It's a market need. A McDonald's is going to come not because somebody called McDonald's and says, have you noticed this? I'm just giving it as an example. McDonald's is going to come because the market bears it. One time I was chair of the Economic Development Commission when we had one, and somebody called me and said, they have a Lowe's on Louise's side. Why haven't you called Target? And I said, trust me, I don't need to call Target and let them know that there's a Lowe's on the other side of 64. And so my point was, I'm not sure what role government can play in identifying and trying to strategically affect how many specialty shops, hardware stores, and so on are here.
I think the role that we play is just to support the industry as it comes, right? And so Fluvanna is very unique and boutique, right? So a lot of our stuff is not chain stuff. But we're here to support Sweet Art Emporium. We're here to support Feather and Fowl in the village. So that's really where we focus on, helping them with those marketing, branding strategies, and getting them to the right resources in our community that they need.
Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you. We'll make sure we make the changes.
All right, we have a motion.
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt the 2023 revised Fluvanna County Tourism Strategic Plan as presented with the amendments discussed.
Okay, all right, we have a motion by Mr. Ryan, a second by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. So next, we have Virginia American Revolution 2050 Commission. Jennifer?
Thank you. So this is going right along with our tourism. So the Virginia American Revolution 2050 Commission was established by the General Assembly in 2020. This was specifically to serve and commemorate the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, the Revolutionary War, and the independence of the United States. So we're really going to specifically celebrate this in the Commonwealth of Virginia. The primary goal of this commission is to convene and facilitate a multi-year series of robust events. So there are events throughout the state. Charlotte just celebrated Monticello a couple weeks ago. So moving on to the next slide. So forming a local 250 commission will enable Fluvanna to join in planning for this large-scale commemoration. And we ask that the Board of Supervisors engage the Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Committee, EDTAC, to serve as Fluvanna County's VA 250 committee, and designate the Director of Economic Development, that's me, as the liaison to work with the VA 250 commission. So what that will do for us, it'll allow us to pretty much unlock other grant opportunities through the Virginia Tourism Commission, and the VA committee. So that's pretty much it, unless you have any questions.
Any questions? When you say celebrate, we're going to have some kind of big event?
So that's really where what we're going to do is, once we adopt the resolution, we get that sent off to Richmond. What it'll do is it will basically, you know, kind of earmark us to be able to apply for funding. So we'll work with the EdTech committee to come up with an event of some type. But it also has like signature events and traveling exhibits, and they also have a VA mobile museum that we could potentially work with public schools to bring into the community, or you know, Pleasant Grove Park. But we also have other historical events that are coming up, and that's why I asked you to sit right here, because we have the courthouse.
Well, 24 is Lafayette, 26 is the 250th, 27 is the formation of the county, 28 is the construction of the Old Stone Jail, and 30 is the courthouse. So there's a lot coming up. And I just want to add to what you were saying about grant opportunities for the US 250. Virginia Humanities just announced today a new grant funding program that they're offering to support organizations and communities that are doing the same thing. So that's just one more grant opportunity that's rolled out. I don't have the numbers. I will say their grants are generally, I think, between 10 and 20,000. So.
Okay, any questions?
No, I was going to say, I recall when I first moved to the States, it was 1774, they were starting to paint all the fire hydrants in red, white, and blue. Because of the 200th anniversary of 1776, which just staggers me that that was 50 years ago. So.
Wow.
Well, I will say this. I learned something. The FLDP subjected one of their classes, they should get an extra certificate, because they had to ride around in the school bus with no air conditioning, with Overton and I as their tour guides. But I learned something that day. Cornwallis retreated from North Carolina, but he headed northward. Decided he wanted to go try to capture Jefferson. And if y'all know this, it jumped me off. Well, when he went to go get Jefferson in the northwestern corner of Fluvanna, he ran into the Albemarle and Fluvanna militia. Looked up on top of the hill and said,
yeah,
I don't think I will mess with these guys. I'm going to head toward Yorktown. So his eastward retreat started at Fluvanna County.
Yeah. I went back and did some history study. Where I was.
Important piece of history. The 250
situation. Yeah, right. Okay, so we have a motion.
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt a resolution entitled A Resolution by the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors Relating to the Support of the Virginia America 250 Commission.
Second.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Bryant. Second, Mr. Sheridan, all in favor?
Uh-huh.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Pull up the resolution, so I guess people read the board packet. It's a very nicely written resolution. So people here, make sure you go to the board packet and read the resolutions. You know, I love to read these things, but I think y'all don't want to hear me anymore. I think we got another resolution, isn't it? Is there another one coming up? That resolution is for well. What do we do with those resolutions? We have a booklet we keep them in?
Yes.
They get attached to the minutes.
Yeah. To the minutes, and yeah.
We talked about putting some of the resolutions in the library as well.
Yeah.
Resolutions.
It'd be nice for the kids, children in school, you know, to read those resolutions. A lot of good information in them.
They have to be maintained permanently, so they're
always
around. Yes. So the resolutions are definitely in the library from the board package standpoint, because all board packages go to the library, but in, mm-hmm. like single resolutions, no.
Yeah.
Book of resolutions.
Okay. All right. Next we have F. Fiscal year 23 to fiscal year 24 carryover request, and Tori Melton, our Director of Finance.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm here tonight to discuss the fiscal year 23 to 24 carryover request.
Can everybody hear her?
How about nice, soft voice.
Okay.
I'm here to discuss the 23 to 24 carryover requests for the county and the schools. So right now, the county currently has a policy in place for our carryover request. And in summary, that policy reads, these amounts are necessary for the continuation of operating projects or services that may be requested by departments for the reappropriation of the budget to the next fiscal year. and such requests shall be specifically defined projects that could not reasonably be started or completed prior to June 30th. So in other words, according to the policy, these items were already budgeted for in fiscal year 23, and we could not complete or start them for circumstances usually out of our control. So typically, there are four reasons why departments request carryovers. Project was started in 23, it was not able to be completed, or the project was not started in 23 due to circumstances out of our control. Both of these would fit our policy. There are also times when departments request carryovers for funds, remaining funds to cover certain one-time projects or special capital projects that were not already approved or funded in that year, or they want to carry over remaining funds for new or unanticipated purposes not budgeted in the current fiscal year. These requests do not typically meet our policy. Next slide.
And just to add one thing to that, the board has approved items that have not met the policy before.
Thank you. So this year, the county currently has six requests, and in case there are additional questions, we do have representatives from each department that can answer any questions. So we're going to start tonight with Social Services. Social Services is requesting a total carryover amount of $13,359. They recently found out that the current phone system that they have is outdated, it's obsolete, it can no longer be serviced. So they did get a quote, this is the amount that they have, and basically if it breaks down, they won't be able to have incoming calls, outgoing calls. And if we wait, there is the potential that it could increase. Next slide. Sorry. Next is Sheriff's Department. They are requesting a total carryover of $25,400. They're requesting $12,000 of that due to training. So in the last 2 years, they were unable to get people into training due to COVID or because of backlog. And they also have new additions to the department. They have two new sergeants, a lieutenant, and an investigator that can really benefit from these classes. They are also requesting $2,800 for a radar. They were unable to get that due to supply chain issues. $3,800 of that for four patrol rifles. Again, supply chain issues, having issues getting those, as well as $6,800 for new computers for the patrol units. Where they were having issues purchasing those for supply chain issues. Next is the Department of Communication. Sorry, I just blanked out. They're requesting a total carryover of $170,000. Previous fiscal year, there was $150,000 put in place for new radios. The county participated in beta testing for the new radios that Motorola was rolling out. And that testing wasn't complete until the end of the fiscal year. So we weren't able to purchase the radios in fiscal year 23. So they're asking to carry that over to 24. And then they're asking for an additional $20,000 to purchase radios for the emergency services department as they have a new ambulance and two new QRBs. So that would help outfit those.
Can I ask on that one? Why would that, if we knew the apparatus was coming, why would that have not been? So that was not, the $20,000 was not part of the previous budget, right?
Correct. This is one, because again, the structure of the EMS department slightly changed a little. Remember when we originally did it, it was just going to be two ambulances. Now there's a QRV involved. And just really early on, when we kind of absorbed some of Fluvanna and Rescue, just not having the necessary up-to-date equipment that was needed. So this is just kind of outfitting the EMS department. Again, starting up a brand new department from the ground up, I would love to say that we anticipated everything that was needed, but we're finding little things here and there just that, as Mr. Chu has been on board as the EMS supervisor, that we just missed, and some things that just need to be addressed.
Thank you.
Especially the two QRBs, they were given to us.
Correct.
I guess we could have told them, we're not going to take them until you put them in.
And next is emergency services. They're requesting to carry over $19,077.88. They could not spend all the funds in 23s. We were still trying to build that department and hire people. So that would really help them in fiscal year 24 get the necessary items that they need.
Yeah, and a lot of that one really, I mean, because remember, you know, we thought maybe we were going to have the department outfitted and moving up a little sooner in fiscal year 23, but we didn't really start hiring people really until it was actually June of 23. So once we got everyone on board and, you know, uniforms and training and just a lot of things like that and equipment, really just weren't able to get that stuff accomplished in fiscal year 23.
The planning department is requesting a carryover of $4,541.95 to complete the comp plan.
Printing and things like that. Printing it and getting a lot of hardbound copies available for the public and available for the board and from just kind of, you know, board members wanted, things like that. And so again, the comp plan is not finished yet.
Yeah.
And so it's when it's complete that it's having the funds available to do that.
And the next request is for Parks and Rec. They are requesting to carry over $4,000 for their site improvement line for their fencing project. Due to the timing of the project, the supplies weren't able to be purchased in 23.
Are you doing the county
first? Okay. So the total carryover amount from 23 to 24 requests are $236,379.
So we gave you a very long list of a la carte. I mean, again, so if you look at the list here, so mostly everything meets the county policy. You know, mm-hmm. the one item, so I'll just kind of start up there. You know, item A, the social services phone system, they were unaware that it was, you know, they didn't have it budgeted for in 23, but they had savings. So it doesn't meet the policy, but things like that the board has approved before because it's a one-time expenditure. So
if it failed, we'd have to come up with the money.
Right.
Correct. And again, you know, the $20,000, as Mr. Fairchild noted before, around E911 and the $20,000 for the radios for the EMS, for the emergency service department, it wasn't budgeted. It doesn't meet policy, but again, it's a one-time expenditure and it makes sense. And then going back to all the others, everything else was basically budgeted for. It just couldn't get started for, you know, just due to timing of things.
What's
so,
the expected surplus?
The audit is finishing up as we speak right now. And so actually at the next board meeting, you'll be getting a presentation on the surplus. I don't have that number for the surplus. I will tell you it'll be far more than $236,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how we
do it, right? Yeah. Okay, so we have a motion for this.
Yes, now you can, if the board says we approve everything, you can say A through V for $236,000.
Okay. Does anybody want to pull anything off of this?
Only have two no's, right?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the following carryover request of FY23 unexpected budget lines from the listed departments to the FY24 department budget lines as specified and in the amounts listed, totaling $236,379 A through V, with a total, reappropriated.
Second. All right, we have a motion by Mr. Sheridan, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and one pass. Okay, next we will have the report from the fiscal year 23 and fiscal 25 carryover from the schools.
So this year we have two carryover requests from the schools. And they are requesting, and Dr. Kelly spoke on this earlier, $488,891.92 to remodel two sets of male and female bathrooms at Central. And they are requesting $30,000 for the student analysis.
One second.
Oh, sorry.
Hold on, you're brief.
We've got one, two.
So again, yeah, the 488-891, as Ms. Melton said, is again to kind of get the bathroom project going. Mr. Stribling or Dr. Gretz are here, they could certainly speak on that. And then the $30,000 was for the schools to do a study. You know, in the past, you know, we've always talked about it, and I've always kind of requested from the schools, hey, what's our capacity? What's our capacity with schools? You know, just with building things, we know it doesn't happen overnight, and so just to try and get a good look moving forward, as they were kind of discussing, you know, when is the county going to be maxed out from capacity in the existing schools that we have? And so, I'd certainly let them speak more eloquently on what the request is. What's that?
What's their surplus?
It's basically this. It's basically the $500,000. Their surplus is the $500,000. What was the exact amount? Do you remember?
Yes, $518,891.92.
Exactly.
Do we have any questions for
the
school? We have Dr. Stribling and Dr.
What's
Dr. Gretz?
Dr. Gretz,
come on down.
Dr. Gretz.
Well, what is the CIP budget amount?
For this bathroom project, I think it's $1.5 million.
Yeah, 1.5.
Yeah, I think these are the same bathrooms Mr. Fairchild and I used when we were students. If I date them that long.
Two of them came after. Two of them were there.
Yeah, the two main ones right across from the main office.
Yeah.
Were there when we were students.
Okay, so here we have.
For the record, I came on quite a while after Mike, but they
How new were they when you got there?
They were built in 1950s or 60s.
How much? 58.
No, so Ms. Booker can answer that one better than I.
Every date, every.
So we've gotten 65 years out of it.
Yeah. Okay, what are your questions for the school people, Mr. Fairchild?
So they were good enough to take Charles Rittenhouse and me on a tour and looking at the bathrooms, and I appreciate that. And I don't know if I mentioned it then, but you know, I know I talked about it with Charles. I don't know why not wait and do it during the budget cycle, during the budget season. Like for example, the bathrooms. They've been there since, what'd you say, 58? Why deal with them in carryover?
The only reason I can say this and I know they've requested carryovers before. It's a little bit of a timing issue. I mean, so if you wait until July 1 when the budget's approved, they won't really be able to do anything during the summer. By the time you do contractual stuff and get things in place, this summer would be kind of a wash. Where sometimes from carryovers in the past, they've requested it so they can get things teed up once school's out with the June time frame. And then they can get some of the projects accomplished over the summer time.
May 25th.
Yeah. And like I said, that's just why that's what's happened in the past, but you know, I'll let you all.
That's a great answer.
That's exactly.
What is the current projected, I guess, 2024, 2025 CIP requests?
A lot.
Like 25 million?
No, I want to say it's, oh goodness, it's 10 to 12 million for fiscal year 24. And then so certainly,
but that's all.
That's all.
But I think one of the other years was even more than that. Like, I think the next year is close to 20 million, but recall. I don't know, it's very high.
I could pull it up. I don't think it's, I don't remember it being 20 million. I could be wrong, though.
But they're both years in which there are a lot of requests.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And again, 10 million, I mean, 10 million is a big amount. I can't imagine, again, you know, we'll see where surplus ends up, but, you know, normally we have not fully funded, you know, I think we did pretty well last year. I think we funded about close to $6 million in projects. You know, the good thing is we were able to use some ARPA funds to get some of the, you know, public safety vehicles and things like that. But, you know, I can't imagine we're going to fully fund $10 million from cash for projects. But
So are we looking at other bathrooms in the future being remodeled, or we are doing the worst of them and the others will sustain their doing things?
The entire project is on the current CIP for FY25, which is a $1.5 million project. This would take care of four of those bathrooms, where I believe there are 24 other bathrooms, singles, and multiple-use restrooms that we were looking at renovating and upgrading as well.
Okay.
Does this take care of those ones that Mr. Fairchild and I were using? I mean, I'm not trying to be, they're the oldest.
Are you trying to be a whiz?
Student population. Where are we looking at right now as far as student population?
30. At, go ahead.
Central or in no, overall?
No, overall.
33, 18.
So we dropped a little bit, stayed about the same, or?
We've stayed about the same. I mean, I would need to look at it to give you an exact answer. We're a little below what we budgeted for this year, which was 33-30.
What was our high point? Do you remember, Dr. Brett?
Ever, or in my tenure?
35, I think.
35, we were at 37.
Yeah, I want to say 2000, was it 2014?
Very close to 35.
If I may, on population. Thank you, I'm so sorry. So we have been on a downward trajectory since 2014 and plateaued over the last couple of years here. We saw some students leave our division around COVID, but what we haven't picked up yet in terms of the numbers are all of the surrounding new subdivisions that, you know, we have one being built across from Effort Church that's going to provide some number of students and some number of families to our community. And the fundamental question is, how many of those people that are going to live there are ultimately going to come to our schools? And not only that, but like, how many are going to be in seventh grade versus third grade? And to be honest, when we have 12 and a half, not quite 13 kindergarten classes now, and Central's packed. Like, I don't know what to do or what to tell the rest of the staff here to do if we pick up another two classes of kindergartners from that division. We're going to have to move grades. We're kind of boxed in a way that is really unique to this rural division, in that we have one building. Each grade level only exists in one building, sans obviously alternative ed. But we're functionally fairly tightly boxed in, and I wouldn't be shocked right now if we end up with trailers at the elementaries in the next couple of years here. And the question is that a Band-Aid that's going to get us through? Or ultimately, are we going to get enough students from these new subdivisions that we're just going to need more space? And I know it's scary to talk about, but at the same time, if we don't know, then we're flying blind. And I don't know where we put the kids if we get an unexpected number.
When is the Colonial Circle going to be completed?
Where's that? I'm looking. Douglas.
3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years.
Okay. That's the entire completion.
That's the entire, I mean, building. barring any type of.
The apartments are less than a year away, probably.
Probably.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, any other questions?
So, that 30,000 for the study, using Colonial Circle as an example, as the big example that's going to bring in so many kids. So that 30,000 was never requested, right? This is new? Yeah. So why wouldn't that have been requested before if that subdivision had been approved since 21? April, I think, of 21?
Yeah, I've never known us to approve something. I mean, do that out that far. I don't know why this would come up anytime in the past. Look to me that it's coming up in the right time because of the buildup around us. But we've been, you know, ever since the domino plan, we have look new that we eventually are going to have to have a new school. You always said it was an elementary, could be a middle, depending on where the grades are. So I think it's good timing for it to come up now.
But I mean, it's why carry over instead of in the budget?
I mean, you could. I mean, that's the school's decision too. I mean, if the board doesn't approve this carryover, I would assume that they would probably include it in their budget request for what they're going to bring forward.
I'm not saying good, bad, or different. I'm just trying to understand the process. So, like last year, early this year, when you made budget requests, we all knew that Colonial Circle was coming. So there's nothing that's transpired since then. Why would this not be a part of the budget process instead of carryover?
My best response to that is really going to be to say that I think that this probably needed to be done earlier. This came about because in my working with Mr. Dahl, and we were talking about planning and talking about facilities capacity, I was requesting some information related to, during the planning process, was there any of this kind of modeling done? And there isn't any. And so he and I coalesced that we should do it and that this was probably the best place to pursue it. This is not my background, it's not my field. When I have done projects in the past, this kind of data would have been pursued long before now.
Yeah, and, you know, it goes a little bit, you know, as we're going through CIP and thinking about buildings and thinking about, you know, things that are being approved and knowing how long things take, it's really about, you know, are we going to be put in a box that we need a school at some point? It would be good to have the information sooner. But again, if the board doesn't want to do it from here, I think they would probably include it in their budget request. If you did it here, I think the bathrooms probably is more of a time-sensitive issue due to the timing of fiscal years. I can't speak on this one. I mean, certainly it's probably needed. Is it needed now versus 6 months from now? I can't speak on that one. I mean, certainly having the information would be helpful, but now to 6 months, that's
the only question I would have, and I'm not 100% certain how, you know, somebody looking at the expected demographic changes based on, you know, the current growth, how they're going to figure that out with no data points to start with. You know, I mean, we don't really know what's going to happen in Colonial Circle. You have a lot of elderly people there. We could have a lot of young families. We could have a lot of single people. We just don't really know that, and so I really question not the need for the survey or the analysis, but maybe the timing for the analysis in terms of will you really get what you're looking from? And I'm not a statistician.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know that there's a lot of expertise offered there. You know, certainly the Weldon Cooper Center provides some insight into expected population growth. I just question how much value would we get out of this? You know, a year from now, we might have a lot more information than we have right now. Is it too late at that point in time?
That's
kind of my real question there.
My experience with this from the school standpoint really is limited to the time that I worked directly with the city council. Let's say 15 years ago, when there were all those developments.
I don't think the public can hear you, Dr.
Oh, I'm sorry. My experience with this is, from the school standpoint, is the work I did directly with this in Goochland. And it's very much a partnership between schools and county. The schools need to respond to the growth, but the schools don't really have a whole lot to do with the growth. And so I'm not enough of an expert to feel like I can tell you what the value is going to be of it. I can tell you that other communities that I've experienced with it have done it far in advance. And these companies, if you do choose to fund it, and if you don't, frankly, I'm going to advocate to the board that we find a way to do it, because I think this needs to be done. We can interview the companies, and they can come in, and they can tell you exactly how they
do it.
Model these things. I can't. But they have some pretty fascinating metrics that they use to be able to tell, again, going back 15 years ago, but they were able to tell us in some of these planned communities, hadn't even broken ground on them yet. And they were able to say, you can expect 1.3 students per unit out of this place. And just to put it in context, that was being done to try to decide where a new Goochland Elementary School would go, which they've just broken ground on. So they were doing that 15 years ago for a school that's being built as we sit here. I think there would be value. I would, you know, want to work with Eric, and if there was value in maybe having the companies come in and do a presentation for exactly what they would do and how they would do it. This resulted, again, from conversations that Eric and I have been having about just being proactive and planning. And a contact that I had through my former work to just get a quick estimate for what kind of a study we would be able to do. I think, you know, obviously before we did anything, we would do some sort of solicitation of proposals and have an opportunity to see something that you don't have right now. I mean, this is based on a verbal estimate that I received.
Would be sort of the expected timeline. We said yes to this, are you expecting that you would have the report 6 months, 3 months?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know how long it would take. It's been too long since I was involved in it for me to remember.
I mean, just if you think about any type of reports like this, I'm certain it would probably take 4 to 6 months at minimum, yeah. is my guess, if I had to guess.
Okay, any other questions for the school people?
Yeah. Here's a full carryover. Do you remember that? Because we already have given part of it back.
Correct? Schools?
The schools that we are, is this the full carryover?
No, this is their only carryover request.
Yeah. I'm thinking back, I've been here a few months. Thinking back to last year.
I think you're thinking about a year ago.
Yeah. That's it.
All right, so if there aren't any more questions or discussion,
as far as the study goes, I mean, I think we're hearing from our county administrator it would be useful to do a study just so that we can be prepared when we have to take action to build a new elementary school or whatever we build.
Again, it was just, like I said, we were just trying to have, you know, Dr. Rutz and myself just have conversations to kind of be, as you said, be proactive, kind of plan ahead, and you know, because every year I'm kind of asking what's the capacity of this school, what's this, you know, when are we going to be pushed in the box when we're out of capacity in the schools?
Speaking of that, my next question would be, have we gotten back to where we were at one point in time, we were having meetings with the chair, and then we started rotating.
We still do that.
We're still doing that.
We're still doing that.
Yeah, we just happened last week.
I'm just like I said.
Yep.
And that's when we talked
to make
about
sure, because that was always helpful that we can each see what's coming across.
Well, I think that's when we started responding was through those.
Yeah, last week we met.
Mr. Fairchild or Mr. Brian, y'all got?
We might want to take two individual votes or not.
Well, yeah, there are definitely two votes. There's a vote, one vote for, since one's going to the operational budget, the $30,000 would go to the school's operational budget, $488 and change would go to the kind of the CIP budget for the very specific purpose for that project.
So to the board and Eric, I mean, so I think of the bathrooms, and they've been there this long. So understanding that if it was in the next budget season, you'd have a summer is going to come where you'd have availability, you know, when the kids aren't there and so on. The $30,000, you know, I'm sure the study needs to happen. Could that not wait for budget season? So to you all, from your experience, is it not better, and what's your opinion about having it in the budget where it's more transparent, there are more citizens who are looking at the budget than looking at this time of year?
I'm not trying to be non-transparent, but if we wait until the fiscal year, then you're down to less than 30 days. to do the changes, because fiscal year doesn't start until July 1 and teachers report July 31 or July 30th. I can't remember what day it is. So, I mean, you got less than a month. If we do this now, then that gives them the opportunity to have 9 weeks to 10 weeks to get whatever things have to be done. And I think that Central, I think, didn't we have to close the schools at one point in time because we had issues with
the plumbing? Yeah, with the pipes, yeah.
We had to close. So that would be my only thought.
I don't think he's talking about the bathrooms. I think he's talking about the studies.
I'm not talking about the studies. He brought up both. I said, so that's why I think the bathrooms, I don't think that's a bad thing. We give them an extra 5.5 weeks. Because you know it's not going to start July 1 if we don't get the money going until July 1. It's not going to start then. So basically you're looking at waiting another year to do it in 2025.
Let me add one thing to your comments, Mr. Fairchild. Let me go for the study specifically. So if the schools had that in their budget, I don't know. I mean, maybe they would line item it, but again, when you get the school's budget, there's not a whole lot of line item. And this is nothing against school. It's not, you know, super detailed from what the board gets. So what you have here has been a very discreet discussion about $30,000 for something that if they put in their budget, you're probably not going to get this level of discussion on it. So that's on the 30. You know, the 488 certainly from the budget or the CIP process. Whether it's here or there, I mean, I think you're getting the same level of discussion. I think for them, I don't want to speak on their behalf, I think they've determined a need for this one, and it's just a timing issue. Because again, if it's not until the July 1 budget that begins, they're not going to be able to do it this summer. It's going to have to wait a whole nother year. And again, going back, the bathrooms have been there for a while. There's another year.
How long have the bathrooms been on the CIP?
I think for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Four.
So
maybe four. Maybe
yeah,
four.
Three at least.
I just can't envision us sending our kids back into those bathrooms with that kind of odor and to just suck it up. I mean, you know, just because, we just keep pushing it down the road. And I just don't think that's good. I would, as a grandma with a little girl in kindergarten, go to school there. I would not want her to think that she has to go in somewhere and hold her nose. And it may not be the bathroom she's going in. Mm-hmm. But,
I don't have a problem with the bathrooms. I think that I do agree in part with what Mr. Fairchild is saying about making I don't think I've heard a compelling reason to say we need to do this $30,000 out of the regular budget cycle season. I think you might get better analysis. So I'll leave it at that. Maybe you have a compelling reason that you want to state right now other than, gee, we have $30,000 left over.
The only compelling reason I have for why we should do this now versus later is that, honestly, we're years late. We're going to see my prognostication, and despite us being able to maybe shift some grades around, we're going to end up with trailers in the next couple of years. And if we don't take steps in order to get that information, then we're just going to be years late in terms of meeting the needs that we have. Now, I understand your argument about, well, once some people move in there, maybe we'll have some more information about what that population looks like and whether it's older or younger. But to be frank, the people who do this for a living know how to model these things and know what certain communities with given demographics look like and nearest neighbor matching to another division that opened in a locality much like yours. And are they going to get it perfect? Probably not, but they're going to get it pretty darn close and give us a sense for where we're at. And I'm confident that when we get the results back in terms of how many students we're going to see in the next couple of years, everyone at this table and in this room is going to be shocked by it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I just want to ask, respectfully, the same question again, because understanding your answers, I'm not sure that any of them answered my question. And you all do have more experience on the board and so on. Do you feel that when things are handled during the budget process, let's say these were approved during the budget process, regardless of whether it would be this summer or the next summer for the bathroom, so on and so on, that there's more transparency, better understood and so on by the citizens more likely to be seen by the citizens if it's during the budget process, as opposed to doing it at some other point in the year when, I mean, isn't that why we have a budget process?
Is this information being kept from the public? I mean, it's very open. It'll be in minutes. It's not a secret.
Well, I think I would, to your question directly, I would say, with regard to the bathrooms, they have been in the CIP budget. They have been advertised. They have been published 4 years in a row. We never fully fund the CIP budget. Never. More often than not, we use the CIP budget as a method to adjust what we would like to accomplish that year in terms of maybe what we feel that is the appetite of the public in terms of tax increases or tax decreases. And certainly we have a CIP budget that is, you know, as pointed out, $10 million. We won't fund $10 million next year. We probably won't borrow the money. It's not the right time to do it, and we won't fund it all. So there will be projects that will be prioritized. I think when you look at a school budget, the size that they have, when you really come down to the percentage that this number is, it's probably in the 1.5% of their total budget, if that, not even that, 0.5%. To the degree that they manage their budget carefully and they get to that point, I don't have any problem with that. When it comes to this study, I take more of your viewpoint of that hasn't been advertised, that hasn't been brought up. It's only $30,000. Is the timing critical? Maybe, maybe not. But it's just one of those, like, okay, we're talking about $30,000. Is it a big change one way or another if they're still going to put in the budget next year? So that to me was the timing. I'm not a statistician. Dr. Kelly is. If he feels like this is the better timing, then okay, I'm not going to argue too much with that. But I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but they've already said they would, if we don't pass it, they're going to put it in the budget. So they'll put it in the
budget. I will certainly advocate for it. Yeah. And I'm not a statistician, I'm a social scientist, but I just want to be...
You work with the models.
I don't want to mislead anyone. I am not a statistician, but I am as close to it as one
can
be with them.
I think they feel that is a great need, that $30,000, when they said, well, we'll do it. If you don't approve this, we're going to get it in budget somehow. And we found that steps.
I don't think 4 months is going to make a huge difference in the $30,000. Now, I think the 4 months will make a huge difference with the bathrooms.
Right. Yeah.
Because then we can address some of the issues that we don't lose days next year because we have flooding going on in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. That's my thought about it.
All right. So are we ready for the motion? Number one.
Go for it.
I move the Board of Supervisors deny carryover of FY23 Savannah County Public Schools unexpended local funds in the amount of $30,000.
I think you just leave it right there.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you. We have a motion by Mr. Sheridan, a second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
All right.
I said deny.
You are in favor of doing it now.
Oh, you said deny?
I said deny. Yes.
Oh, I didn't catch it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I was giving you the option to second.
That's okay. It's still passed or denied at 3-1.
Well, and it surprised me that your vote for it, what you just said. Okay.
No, I said sorry.
You never know.
All right. And okay. Motion
so
number
we,
two.
So we ended up with.
Just for clarity on the vote.
You want to change your vote, Mr. Fairchild?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
You're in favor now.
I'm in favor of denying.
Oh, so okay. Four ayes.
Okay. So you do want to change your vote?
Yes.
From
yes.
A to A. Right.
Do you have a payment? No.
All right, yes. Motion number two.
Yes.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve carryover of FY23 Fluvanna County Public Schools unexpended local funds in the amount of $488,891.92 to the FY24 CIP budget for the schools for the following items: central bathroom renovation.
Second.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Sherrod, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
All right, anyone opposed? Chair votes aye.
All right, you sure you want to do what you want to do?
You're an aye? I don't know. What
did you say?
He did. He's aye. He was aye.
Oh, okay.
He was aye.
All right, that was fine.
Sorry.
Oh, wow. Who is this we have here? All right, he's ready to go. Thank you. We have the buildings, the Commonwealth, the county attorney and Commonwealth attorney building renovation. Mr. Calvin Hickman, Director of Public Works.
Public Works was tasked with either uplifting or retrofitting two of the buildings on Main Street. One houses the Commonwealth attorney, the other one, 211 Main Street, would be the new county attorney building. We started the process of upfit, and as we dug into it, we found out it was going to be a little bit more money than we had planned on putting into the building. And so tonight is a presentation on how much money we have to invest into the new county attorney's building.
Can everyone hear Mr. Hickman though pretty good? He's tall and the phone and mic.
Make sure you stay low. Close to it.
Yeah. Stay close to it, Mr. Hickman. Yeah. Thank you. All right. Oh, look at these nice pictures.
So there's pictures of the building. You can see it. The building was built the 1930, pre-1930. It's housed a lot of county facilities. The county library was in there at one time. Commonwealth attorney was in there at one time. The registrar was in there just previously to where we find it today. And so to have the county attorney in there, we had to make some alterations to the walls. And you can see some of the pictures reflect that. Once we got into the building, the mechanical has to be changed out, new building codes to address when we looked underneath the building, we found there was termite damage and water damage. And so you see the prices reflected in the numbers for the estimate of for rehabilitating the building. It's not far from $200,000. And so tonight I'm coming forward to see if we want to put that money into that building.
So are we going to, do we have a motion for both buildings?
There's two separate motions for each
okay.
Building.
Okay, and I think this one is still the, this one is the common attorney?
This is county attorney.
County attorney.
Yeah.
County
okay.
Attorney.
All right.
So what is it? I mean, it's obviously not in current use right now.
It's not.
When was it last in current use?
When the register, well,
it's the registrar's office.
The registrar wasn't in for many, many years. So let me go back to, so the main walls were roughly in place, but there was one big office area that was there before that really needed for Mr. Whitten to get really to house what we budgeted for our county attorney's office to get in there was really to build another wall. And create a hallway, because again, if you go, let me see here, I'm trying to get my bearings. So here's the front, the top of the screen is the front door to go in. When you went in there before, there was this long skinny area, then this was one big open area right here. And so again, the board approved to hire a county attorney, an assistant county attorney, and a paralegal. In the current configuration, to go back to the bathroom, you'd have to go through the county attorney's office, and even in addition with that, you don't have enough office space in there for what the board approved for county attorney. So originally, we were looking at just doing some small retrofits, creating an office in there from kind of one of the larger spaces. Once you kind of get into that, and Mr. Hickman can talk about it, I mean, so the floors, the subfloors were in horrible shape. Once you start this,
yes, we different things we did. We ended up putting a new subfloor onto the existing floor. It was one bys, and we lifted the suspended ceiling out. All the lights had to be
removed, electricity had to be removed, because you just had a new configuration. You know, as you can see, there was going to be a center hallway going back to the back of the building. There was going to be a kitchenette back there. The bathroom had to be totally gutted and reinvented back there.
The building was in rough shape. I mean, I don't know when that building had any upgrades in the...
I would say at least 50 years before any upgrades to that building.
So what's the total amount we're investing in this?
Here's just a couple pictures to see. I mean, when you look at some of the floor joists underneath the building, I mean, as Mr. Putnam said when he came up here, again, he was a former county employee at the time, and Mr. Hickman, that's the cost right there, just to do the repairs to the building, the upgrades that need to be done from carpentry to the crawl space, structure damage, plumbing, HVAC, ceiling, flooring. You've got $165,000 there. Now, what's not included, and these are kind of what I guess I would call nice to haves or add-ons. I mean, again, the awning, I don't think the awning one is necessary. The kitchenette, I don't necessarily think that's necessary.
Where was the kitchenette going to be?
It was going to be in the back. Yeah, back. I mean, you probably need, I mean, there's going to be some costs that are needed maybe out of this, but nothing, I don't think all of this is necessarily needed on this screen per se. But to go back to this screen, I mean, I think.
This includes what we've already spent. I mean, this is.
All we've spent so far is $13,000 to do some of the framing and the. So we've done some asbestos abatement because, again, it was an old building, some asbestos testing, and then some framing. And again, when they pulled up the carpet, the subfloor was horrible.
So you've actually spent $17,268.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, yeah, right. Yes. Yeah, the 13 for the plus the below stuff.
So on this first page, everything that's in there you'll feel like is essential.
Yeah, and Kelly, you
for the 170? Correct. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That is needed to bring the building to living status. Kind
of. Real quickly, the 17 comes off the 165, 720?
It can, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff has already been paid.
Correct.
Say that again?
The 17,268 comes off of the 165, 720. That's what's already been paid. Mm-hmm. We've already...
Yes.
165, 720 is the total that you think is going to be the construction stuff that needs to be done.
Yes.
So, and I mean, that makes that go down to 148.
Yeah, so with this, I mean, you know, Mr. Hickman and I talked about it a good bit. I mean, do I love it? No, I don't actually. One, this was only supposed to be roughly maybe a $50,000 project at one point. Just do some repairs, and then once you start breaking into it and getting into it, and cost increases, it's just becoming astronomical. So going back to, I don't love this. I definitely don't love this idea, but I think it's a necessary need right now. And you know, going back to the buildings, I mean, so at some point, the county is going to, you know, the discussion was always that the county is going to divest itself of these buildings in the future. So, you know, you look at it one of a couple two ways. So one, we obviously don't have any mortgages on these buildings or anything like that. They've been paid for probably quite some time. So when and if the county ever decides to sell it, so if you have a building that is brought up to code, that is up to certain standards, I think you're more likely to get an interested buyer or a tenant in there that lifts up the village of Palmyra. If we don't do anything, we've got a building there. Even before some of this work was done and opened up, you've got a building in there that needed significant improvements. So you either would have had someone that came in and bought it on the low, on the cheap side, and was going to have to put a lot of money into it, or maybe they didn't. Maybe they just left it as is. So looking at the pros and cons, one, we need the space for one. I mean, so one, you know, we can't hire an assistant county attorney right now, basically until we have the space. We don't have the space. So that's one piece of that. And again, you know, our push is, you know, at the earliest, you know, so we're starting to work on the RFP for a new design for, you know, the kind of the new county complex, but that's, you know, from design and building, that's going to be three to 5 years. And so in the interim, we are absolutely 100% tapped out for space. We have nothing. And so I think it's a need. It's an unfortunate need, and the costs are unfortunate, but I think it's a, I think it's necessary.
Is it coming out of general fund or is it?
I would say out of unassigned fund balance. I mean, I think if I could pull up what it was in the board package, I think you have it right there.
Well, my only question would be if we just wanted to tear it down, how much would it cost to tear that building down and have it all taken out of there?
$10,000 or $15,000.
That's all?
Just to tear it down.
But that would be plus the $17,000 we've invested in it already.
That is correct.
And then you've got an empty lot that's not really.
Correct.
You're going to get your money back out of it. I think Mr. Dahl's point is correct, that whether you're renting the space, if you're putting, because I mean, it's just, the village has been paid for forever, right? So whatever
an investment
to sell the building or to lease the building down the road. Mm-hmm.
Right. So fund balance, okay.
15.75. Yeah. And again, that's above and beyond our 12% reserve that we have. That's roughly around 10-11 million. So 15 million is
26-27 million, yeah, that we had.
Yeah. And plus, when the audit, there will be some more money going back.
But we'd already allocated $50,000 in the CIP request. That basically we did.
What's that? No, this was going to be covered out of the public works budget to kind of do some of the, you know, what was deemed to be lesser upgrades. But just as you're getting into it, it's far more than what was originally expected.
Okay, so I'll be ready to make a motion on
Mr. Fairchild?
Well, I'll just say, it's, I mean, we're already this far into it, and, you know, we want Palmyra to be
vibrant again.
Yeah, and in a, for lack of a better way to say it, kind of a touristy environment, it's not historic compared to the courthouse, but is a historic type of building that, to me, we're this far into it, I don't see how we have much choice but to spend the money. And out of that, we've preserved a building that will look different than anything that would be built there if it was torn down. So I would go for it.
All right.
And so we'll come back to the motion. So let me go back to the Commonwealth Attorney's one next, and I'll let Calvin talk about that.
But we didn't address the additions, though, right?
We did. Let me go down to them and. Yeah, so yes, we didn't really address the additions.
And can we hold off on some of that till putting it in the budget?
I think we probably could. I am hoping that there's going to be some.
Like the $38,000 for the HVAC seemed very high to me, but
I had the same conversation with Mr. Edgley about that.
A little too high, and a little too low.
And I understand that's doing all the duct work and all that.
Yeah.
We got three bids. That was the low bid.
Mr. Wade doesn't need that much cooler.
We already
have an acreage in Dexter.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think these things are needed.
Yeah, some of those things are
needed.
They are needed.
And they're
going to
need furniture.
Yes, let me give you the female approach.
That's regular budget stuff.
Yeah, kitchenette. Right. What kind of furniture do we already have in there? 1500 is a lot. Shelving. You're going to need shelving.
Can we do this?
Blinds. You may not even need the $1,000. I don't know what appliances you're going to get for $15. Now, what appliances? Your coffee pot?
I mean, we don't even have a kitchen in the county administration building.
Huh?
We don't have any type of kitchen or anything in the county.
You do. You got one up here, right over here.
Mr. Whitten's office.
Not in the administration building.
And it, well, we got many counted. That's just a good point.
So Dan, if you need a kitchen, everyone's coming up to your office.
Wash your dishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So that's the county. Well, let's do the Commonwealth attorney next.
Yes.
So, Mr. Hickman, you go, would you?
The Commonwealth attorney's building, it's almost as old as the other building.
Do you have a year on that one?
You know, I can look at my paperwork.
No, don't search for it. Yeah, just interested.
Yeah, it was a general store. That's right. I think it burned down in 1930. Was that? I think I might
have. Okay,
yeah, they built it back. Then it was a store. But when it was built, it did not have a concrete floor in the basement, and that floor was added later. It was probably hand constructed. They probably mixed that concrete themselves. Today, that concrete is spalling, and you can see it. It's just totally deteriorating. And what that's allowing to happen is the moisture is weeping up out of that floor and into the building. We run dehumidifiers down there, Jeff and his office, four of them down there, constantly down there, emptying those. And they really don't need to be doing
that's
that.
That's why he's lost all that weight. He's going up and down those steps.
So we have proposed a new heating and cooling system with dehumidification down there. We had to look into a lot of specialists and how to seal that floor. Very difficult to seal that floor, and people are not guaranteeing that it's going to be sealed more than a year because of the way it just falls apart down there. And if we wanted to fix that, it's more long-term, new concrete, a whole lot more money if we're going to invest in it that way. But sealing the floor and then coming back over it with BCT is how we propose to do it. That's going to make that space, people being able to work down there. They store a lot of files down there now, and it's going to keep the moisture level down. There's also some issues on the walls where we're going to need to do some work. You saw my numbers in there. It's an estimate. We don't know what that's going to be because those walls have not been exposed yet to see what work we got to do.
And again, in the basement, no one's currently in the basement as far as office space. No. Jeff had requested, you know, with the victim witness coordinator having a space to meet for individuals that come in. That space at one time used to be the, I think investigators used to be down there at some point. So the space was utilized and there's file cabinets down there. But just with the issues that Mr. Hickman spoke about, to have the space any more usable, again, you're kind of going back to there's costs associated with that. And you can see that's kind of the, as Mr. Hickman spoke about the spalling of the concrete there, that's just kind of one example of what it's doing. So that's the cost for that building. And again, I think kind of going back to what we talked about for the county attorney's building, again, once everything moves, you know, the county admin building would become more of an expansion of the judicial complex. You know, Jeff's office would move up there. So again, this would be another building that the county is looking to, you know, whether they sold it, whether they leased it, whatever they did. And again, you know, the upstairs is in good shape. The upstairs is in good shape where the offices are. But downstairs, you know, it could provide some additional square footage if it's sold or leased or whatever. But right now, I mean, same thing with Jeff. He's out of space, so he can't do anything else unless he gets some of that space down there.
Okay.
Any reason not to wait on the basement of the Commonwealth Attorney's Office until the budget?
We could. I mean, yeah, well, yeah, I mean, I know, I guess the only thing I would say to that is I know from the dehumidification standpoint, I think there's a concern with the moisture in the building, the moisture in the basement, and then how that really kind of plays into the entire building. But he doesn't have that extra space right now, and his folks, his staff are actually going down there. I don't know how often they're going down there, but his staff are actually going down there to change like little dehumidifiers all the time.
But all those things have been true, right? I mean, there's nothing new about any of that, right?
It just didn't pop up.
Yeah.
It just didn't pop up, you know, yesterday.
So there's really no reason that we couldn't wait until the budget, right?
No, you could. I mean, yeah.
I mean, there's no health and safety issue that's any different than last year, the year before, right? I mean, there's no pressing. Nothing's going to change from now until sometime in the next year.
The only thing it would do is it would prolong what he is hoping to do with the space. That's the only thing it would do.
How much is left in the public works budget?
For this fiscal year, I don't. Well, I mean, so you can do one of two things. There's CRMs. I mean, you can pull it out of unassigned fund balance. You could try and piecemeal it. I mean, I can tell you, public works doesn't have. I mean, the facilities budget doesn't have $68,000 necessarily. And
CRM budget.
You could CRM, and that was the thing, because of the size of these, I put unassigned fund balance, but if the board says, well, we don't want to fund it out of unassigned fund balance, we want to do it out of CRM, well, we could bring CRM forward at the next meeting.
Have we been taking money out of CRM?
A little bit, yeah.
So you know what's in?
Well, I'm sorry?
Do you know how much what is in it?
I'm going to use someone can tell me.
Phone a friend.
I want to say probably in the there's probably $700,000-$800,000 in the county CRM I'm thinking right now.
Yeah.
More or less four.
$764,155.
There you go.
Yeah.
So and again, I mean, so technically, yes, both of these projects could be funded out of CRM if the board wanted, or just due to the size, it could be unassigned fund balance. But that's a.
I mean, it seems like this is exactly what CRM is for.
We put it aside.
I'm sorry, Missy.
That's exactly
what
we're
doing. Yeah. We kind of forget it's there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the way to do it. That sort of addresses Chris's concern, Kershaw's concern about, you know, should it wait or not? I mean, this is capital reserve maintenance.
Yeah.
It is budgeted money for these purposes.
It is due to the cost, the size of the cost of these, we wanted to bring it to the board's attention.
Make sure it goes in front of us.
Yeah, make sure you saw it. And again, however you want to fund it, if you want to do fund balance or if you want us just to bring, now that you've seen the presentation, we can certainly bring them back on a CRM that goes in the board package, but that would just go under consent. But you've heard the discussion on the why and the cost.
Mr. Fairchild, are you okay with that?
Maybe.
If we were to do those two?
Yeah. I mean, clearly we got to spend the money. It's just a concern to me of when, and again, the transparency and the process of it, but yeah, I'm good with that.
So no motions needed then. So then what we'll do, we'll just put it in the capital reserve, and it'll come on the next board meeting for, it'll be on the second.
All right, good. Thank you.
Thanks, Dylan.
All right, this next one is recommendation for appointment to the Board of Zoning Appeals.
He's making a recommendation.
Yeah, Ms. Lees, refresh my memory. Is there just one?
There's two people that are.
One position.
There's one position, I'm sorry, and two people that are able to fill it.
Right, but. You have it as a line item for recommendation. Are you making a recommendation, or is
it your recommendation?
No,
the board has to make a recommendation to the circuit court.
To the circuit court, right. Okay.
The board doesn't appoint, the board makes a recommendation, and then the circuit court appoints.
Right, okay. And it's Peter.
So, yes, Peter. Is there a better?
Sorry, guys.
Which one do you want to go to?
He's currently serving.
All right, we have a.
Yes.
Okay, we have a motion on
it.
There's two. So in the docs.
Yes, the next one down is.
Okay, Peter and.
There's Peter Van Kajal, and he is currently on the Board of Zoning Appeals.
Right. Okay.
And then
you had
Woody Fincham.
Woody Fincham. And I don't. Is what do you finish him on any other boards?
Right now, he's on the BOE, which ends...
That's right, he's on the...
At the end of December, so he would be eligible for this position, which would start January 1. Yeah. He can't serve on multiple boards on the BCA. Yeah.
He's currently on the BOE, as you said. It ends December 31st. This would be effective January 1. So Woody Finchel would is also, and then there's one more you said?
No, just the two.
Just the two, okay.
But Peter's the current.
Correct.
Correct. Yeah. Really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's both, I think. Yeah. Once again, we got two qualified candidates.
Right.
But I will.
Okay.
How long has he been on the board?
He replaced Carol Walker.
Wow, that was a long time ago.
Von Kaiserland's been on there for a long time. Carol Walker, they served concurrently.
Yeah. I was going to say, Miss Walker didn't go off until
last year or so, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so where's the
motion right there?
I move the Board of Supervisors recommend to the Circuit Court, Peter H. von Kaiserland, for appointment to the Board of Zoning Appeals, at-large position with the term to begin January 1, 2024, and ending December 31st, 2028.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
All right, we have a motion by Ms. Sheridan, second by Ms. Fairchild. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Okay. All right, we have the appointment to the CPMP with the Region 10 board. The lady moved up to the Region 10 in Charlottesville. And so we have Mark
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the following Board Commissioner Committee appointment. Community Policy and Management Team of the Community Services Board, Mr. Mark Heinlein, beginning term of 12/6/2023. No one after the board.
Okay.
Second.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Bryan and second by Mr. Chair. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Okay. And he's already sat on the CP already, so he knows what's there. Okay, now we have presentation. Okay, Regional Transit Governance Study. Lucinda Shannon, Transportation Program Manager with TJPDC. Hi.
Hi, thank you for allowing me time on your agenda tonight.
Yes.
About this time last year, I was before you with the Regional Transit Vision Plan, making recommendations for transportation services in the all of Region 10. Part of that plan recommended that we conduct a governance study for the region to identify additional funds to implement the services recommended in the vision plan, and also to form a body to help govern those funds and plan regionally for transportation. We were fortunate enough to have support from Albemarle County and the City of Charlottesville and the Department of Rail and Public Transportation to fund a second study, and we hired AECOM, a consulting agency, to conduct the Regional Transit Governance Plan. Stephanie Amokin is here tonight online and will be sharing her findings with you.
Okay.
Hi, good evening. May I please be given sharing privileges so that I have a very short PowerPoint I'd like to share with you all tonight?
You do that, Kelly, or do I?
Let me see. I think if I make her a co-host.
All right. Try now, Stephanie.
Okay.
There we go.
There it is.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for giving us the privilege to share at this meeting. We have a very short time, and the purpose of our presentation is just to introduce you to this study. This has been a year-long effort starting last November, and it's really been a discovery process on regional transit governance. We wanted to see what other regions are doing, regions that are similar to ours, to the Charlottesville region, to see what is allowed under state law and what precedent there is. So my name is Stephanie. I'm Wayneen Yangson. I'm with AECOM, and I've been supporting the TJPDC through this effort. At the end of this presentation, we don't need the county board to make any resolution. This is just for informational purposes only. Our project team, like Lucinda mentioned, was in collaboration with TJPDC and the AECOM staff. Now, just to give you a little background on these efforts, as far back as 2008, there's been efforts to improve transit service throughout the region. So the efforts from 2008 led to the eventual creation of the Regional Transit Partnership in 2017. The purpose of the partnership was to serve as that forum to allow coordination for regional transit. And after that, some other studies were funded in this same vein. Just last year, a regional transit vision study was completed. And what this regional transit vision proposed were two networks that we assumed for this as a premise for this study. Now, the improved network for the region has upgraded transit for both the urban network and the rural network. That means increased hours of service, increased days of service, and different types of service. And so going into this study, we really had two main goals. First was to identify through research, what are potential governance options if we wanted to look at regional transit? And second, how are we going to pay for all of the improvements that are proposed? And so we undertook a five-phased approach for this study. We looked at the existing conditions. So who are the providers in the region? What kind of services are they offering? And what are those governance structures? Next, we did the national peer analysis, looking at regions that are similar to Region 10 to try to understand how they provide transit to their residents. Next, we did an assessment of potential revenue generation options. And lastly, we looked at potential governance options. So again, this was all a discovery process to see what was available out there for further steps to be taken. What we also did was to make sure there was a lot of engagement throughout the process with both our representatives from the county boards and staff members throughout the region, as well as other regional entities like the MPO, the TJPDC. At the state level, we also engaged with DRPT, with VDOT, as well as other authorities that have been established in the region. So these include HR TAG. We also looked at Hampton Roads Transit, the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, WADA, and like I mentioned before, DRPT and VDOT. And in addition, we looked at the national peers. And so these were our regions where we saw that regions that had both urban and rural populations, as well as a major university in those regions. And so we looked at Ann Arbor, Blacksburg, Bloomington, Iowa, Ithaca, and State College. And so after all of this research and a lot of engagement with our local stakeholders, We identified some key findings that we, the region can continue efforts in discussing. So the first one is, we saw that there's a general desire for regional transit that is improving the service to the populations that need it the most, and for those that are currently using it, to improve it. However, the steps to that end goal, there are a few steps to that end goal. And so in the interim, what we suggest is that an interim entity be set up. And what that could look like is starting out with a small committee that can represent the different stakeholder perspectives to continue to champion these efforts. They can look at what potential bylaws could look like, how different perspectives can be represented, what university engagement could look like, and other articles of organization. And so this would look like an actual working group that would be drafting all of these elements where all localities can have feedback and make sure that it's representative of what the region wants. Next, we also realized that throughout our discussion, something that came up was the need for transit needs assessment for our rural localities. We saw that with the current service, there's still a need to understand where populations that need it the most are located, what kinds of services could be improved, the proportions of county residents that actually need the service. And then another thing that came up was also potential interjurisdictional travel outside of areas in Region 10. And so we strongly suggest that some research be done in this direction to look at what kind of services can be provided on a detailed level for rural transit. We also saw that there was this perceived value of who receives more value when it comes to the urban and rural divide in terms of controlling our regional governance, regional transit governance. And this is not uncommon. Again, we just have to make sure that as this effort continues, that all perspectives are represented. One thing that can be done is to, as the results of the rural transit needs assessments are completed, it can be evaluated against the proposed vision networks that this study was based off of. We can also look at different mechanisms that can be put in place if a regional transit authority is established to ensure that if there's any revenue generated, it's distributed equitably across the region. Finally, we also saw that UVA is in a position to be a crucial member or a crucial stakeholder in regional transit. And so we want there to be continued engagement with the university to try to identify areas in which we can collaborate with them and they can serve as a strong partner. So for example, in the cases, the peer cases we looked at, we saw that in all of the cases, regardless of the kind of governance the transit had, they had a strong relationship with the university, whether it was financial or contractual with providing transit service. There's also potential to leverage additional funding for those transit investments. Whether at the state level or federal level, we can also explore what grant funding could look like with the university partnership and leveraging that that partnership with them. There could also be potential cost-sharing mechanisms with a regional authority and the university's transit system, UTS, whether it is cross-training programs, or other administrative costs that could be shared. Finally, an example that we saw in one of the Pierce cases was also collaborating on innovative transit projects with their universities as a way to raise more funding for transit in the region. And so with these findings, what we also did was looking at the Virginia context, what were potential revenue sources that we could raise for Region 10. Now looking at our existing transit authority, transportation authorities like the NVTA, the HR TAC in the Hampton Roads, and the Central Virginia Transportation Authority in the Richmond area, we saw that there were a variety of sources. However, in further discussions with representatives from these agencies, as well as from at the state level, we narrowed down the list into the feasible options for the Region 10 area. And on the right side is the list of those potential options. Now, this is not an exhaustive list, but it is a starting point of where more funding can be raised. Now, in our final report, we have details on what the potential estimates that can be raised across the region are. Now, with these potential sources, we also looked at what an ideal potential solution for regional governance could look like. Now, excuse me, with in the current state legislation, there is allowance for the creation of a transit authority in the Charlottesville area. However, it does not include funding. So what would be an ideal solution would be to modify that legislation or to create a new legislation that does allow that funding component. And what the membership could look like would be with Charlottesville and Albemarle, with the option of the rural surrounding localities to participate if they wish to, and have a governing board that has members appointed from the local localities' governing boards. In our final report, we have details on what the authorities, the powers and responsibilities of the said authority would also be. Now, this is just a very brief summary on this year-long study, like I said before. But what at this stage is we just need all our local stakeholders to review the details in our final report, continue discussions on transit needs with all perspectives, and then set up that working group, volunteer working group, to continue to champion efforts. And so this, thank you very much again for your time, and I can take any questions that you have at this time.
Do we have any questions? Anyone?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We don't have any questions at this time.
Thank you.
You want to say something?
I was just going to thank you for your time.
Yes,
and
thank
thanks,
you.
Stephanie, for being available.
Yes,
Stephanie,
well, Stephanie, very well done. Thank you. Okay. All right, now we have Vito, I think, here, quarterly report. Scott Martin. Is he on?
He's right here.
Oh, okay. Any person? Great.
Madam Chair, board members, good evening. So I have a just fairly quick report for you all. So on the maintenance side of the house over the last quarter, we've been making a really big push on roadside maintenance. While you know, we try our best to get the signs up and everything that we talked about last time before the board, they do pop up time to time, but we do continue to make that push. Aside from that, really big focus on tree trimming, daylighting signs, and ditching. They have done a tremendous amount of work between Zions area headquarters and Palmyra area headquarters on removing, reopening ditches, reopening pipes, and things like that. We also have had several contractors in your area over the last 6 months DMI, working on ditches, construction, working on pipes. They have concluded their work for the remainder of the calendar year. A lot of that work, we haven't had ditching done in several years. So a lot of ditching and a lot of roadside work has been done, and we look to have them resume sometime in the spring. We are also working on potential solutions with Lake Monticello for the Monarch Gate. Talked to traffic engineering. We had a discussion and a meeting with staff on the smart scale. And so we've looked with traffic engineering. We're looking at some signage options. We're looking at some things, and we are going to be working with the Lake Monticello POA on what that looks like. And Mr. Dahl, I'll get with you once we have everything back from traffic engineering. Next week, we have the public hearing for Troy Road roundabout. It's Troy Road 250. That'll be at the Best Western of the Designs. We did get revised PSI locations for the next round of smart scale. So once our planning folks have concluded that evaluation, they'll be reaching out to staff to talk to them, and I will be back in front of you in the spring so we could be talking about pre-applications and what those look like on the next round of smart scale.
I think you just lost the mic.
Yeah. Probably batteries.
Well, I'll just talk a little loud.
There you go.
So you probably lost me PSI locations. So planning staff is going to look at that, and we will be re-engaging with staff. And then the last thing I had, we have new land use staff. We've got new inspectors. And we are fully staffed since I've taken this role 2 years ago in Lane. So I know a lot of the review times and things like that have been a little longer than we would have liked. So hopefully the last person starts on Christmas Day or the day after Christmas. And so we will be officially all seats full. So
do you have any trash schedules, trash pickup? But, you know, remember, you did one October. Winfield and Oakland, Tigertown, I don't know what people are doing. It looks like they're just throwing it out the window. It is so much trash.
I'll have Chris take a look at that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. Anything else we want to bring to us?
I have another question about the South Boston Road safety study in between Broken Island and
Riverside
and all that. What's the status of that?
So we have the counts back. They're going back through and getting additional drain footage because we were waiting until we had the leaf fall to get that. We haven't quite had what we needed to get that done yet. So they're going to go back, get that, because they got it at the end of the summer, but we really wanted to get it when school was going. We had the leaf fall, we had better views of it. So we just haven't been able to get it yet. So
you have two people here that use that every day and can tell you.
They're
right on top of you.
Sure.
You don't need a drone to figure that one
out. My vehicle's slightly larger than his.
Yeah. And in my vehicle, a lot of times it's within 2 seconds of a collision.
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
This one I think I've asked you before, but I'm going to ask again. Coming out of the Crofton section, which is that first section when you go up the hill from the intersection that we're talking about, from the sewer plant on 618?
Yes.
Coming out of there, there are trees blocking your view on both sides. That would be Lake Monticello's Property Owners Association, or is that VDOT right-of-way?
So we've looked at that several times. Everything that's in VDOT's maintenance purview has been trimmed and laid back, so anything remaining.
There's two 18-inch trees to my left that I've got to catch a vehicle as it passes between the 6-foot-tall privacy fence and those two trees, then they disappear for 150 feet.
And unfortunately, if it's not dead, we can't.
That's why I was asking.
Yeah.
And then, because the other one is a cedar tree that, when I come out there to the left, okay, here I go.
Yeah, the best thing we can do, and I will have our folks work towards it, is we can engage with the property owner and see if they will let us take it down. But if they say no,
then you don't have a choice.
We do not.
What are the requirements for, and I don't know what the right terminology would be, but you know, when you're approaching a road, it's not a speed bump, but it's just a little
The rumble strip. How's it go again?
I know rumble strips are just in the middle or not, but yeah, kind of like when you just go. You know, that just that little section right there, two of those rumble strips on either side, you got the curb coming up, people fly on that curb, lots of accidents happen. You have the accidents on either side of Broken Island, or you have the accidents on the Riverside Gate entrances. Just wake up, hello, you're coming in, you know, pay attention.
There is no cure that very they have for stupid, because
I know,
well, yesterday I tried to turn right into Riverside. I certainly hope the person's not listening, but if they are, I'm turning right into the intersection. I think I've got the right of way in a school bus. So I look in there to make sure it's not somebody coming out, because I've got to swing wide so I don't drop my tire in the ditch. And as I'm looking this way, I see something out of the corner of my eye. And I went, crap! I slammed on the brakes. The person wanted to get in front of me, so they were coming up the hill from the sewer plant and just shortcut the turn so they could beat me into the Riverside section.
Wow.
And if I don't see them, I T-bone that person.
Right.
It's just unfathomable how you could do that to a school bus.
Wow. Did you take the license plate?
Ma'am. No, ma'am. I did not, but they were a very graphic description of the person, because they didn't look at me. They just put their hand up and waved and kept driving. I felt really
the roundabout at Troy Road and 250, right?
Yes.
Is that a done deal? Meaning that's.
How do you mean? Is it?
Meaning it's coming.
It's funded. Yes.
Yeah. When does that happen again?
2025, wasn't it?
I believe so. I believe
this
that's correct.
This is large scale, but there's that we qualified because of the accidents that we've had and the issues with that section.
Gotcha.
But I don't think we don't have to fund any of it. That's all through
SmartScale. That's all through SmartScale. That is correct.
But I'm sorry, my question wasn't. I didn't maybe finish my question. What are sort of the requirements for when you can put in those kinds of rumbles?
So what you would do is you would look at the accidents. You would look at what their efficacy actually is. So I think in that intersection that we're talking about, we would look at one, what the accidents are. The accidents more one way or the other, and then what type of rumble strips you would put in for that particular section of road. Personally, I would recommend the pavement markings, the striped ones, rather than the ones that are dug into the pavement. But the thing with that is it has to be a continuous yearly done thing with the annual remark, because we'll tear it up with snow plows every winter.
I hate to say this one time, but some of the issues that I run into right there are, you put rumble strips there, they're just going to drive on the other side of the road so they don't hit them. I mean, I hate to say it that way. But.
Well, these aren't really, I mean, all these are audible alert. In a past life, we've installed them on primaries just to give everyone, you know, that there's an intersection coming where it was a blind intersection or things like that. But if the issue is people pulling out, and it's not a mainline issue where you've got mainline speeding, but people pulling out, doing one without improvements to the side street,
right?
You would have to do a little bit of better.
You definitely have a potential speeding issue on that turn into the Broken Island turn there. And then, likewise, you're coming out of a blind curve, coming right on top of that intersection where you can have two left-hand turns depending on which way you're going.
Sure. But I can have that discussion with traffic engineering and let staff or yourself know.
Well, you've been bringing this up year after year after year after year. And I understand you have your metrics under which you have to do it, but when an accident happens there, it's a bad accident.
Okay.
Because the cars are going 45, 50 miles an hour. And it's a depot, and it's just a bad accident.
Okay, any more concerns, questions? Anything else?
I've made up my mind, sorry.
Thank you, sir.
We appreciate you coming in and waiting and being so patient.
Yeah, have a good
we'll take care of you next time.
Thank you, too.
Yeah. Well, Eric, did you hear that we need to move up?
Well, we can always do that, like board presentation.
Yeah, but you want to keep it in the forefront. I mean, he could do it
We can, because I remember previously the board reshuffled how some things were.
To me, this is one of those things where I should have said something. When we had 9 action matters, we knew that was going to take a while, and unfortunately, they're just going to have to sit and wait because they got us. That's when we only had 2 presentations. We probably could have shot them to the front and just got that over. Just food for thought.
Right.
I agree.
Just food for thought.
You think about that after. It's like golf, you know, that muster shot's always better than the first one.
But we would have left the TJPDC to present till now because they love us.
All right. Now we're at the consent agenda. Minutes from November the 15th, 2023, and minutes from November 20th, 2023. Accounts payable report for 2023P, emergency management budget transfer to emergency services. Q, resolution recognizing Charles Wilford Palmer, D, of Eagle Scout, and RCRMF Emergency Services repairs to Ambulance 49. Anyone like to pull anything? I'd like to pull Q. Resolution. Mike, can you do this resolution?
Want me to read it?
For Charles?
Well, absolutely.
I mean, I'm sorry, not it's for the Scouts.
Eagle Scouts. All right.
It's on the 9th, I think.
Of December. What's that? I cannot do that. I will be headed south like a goose.
With the 9th of December, I can probably do that.
Yeah, okay. Is that St. Peter's and Paul?
Who could do that?
Eagle Scout.
To do what? To
you read,
recognize
you read
them at the event?
When they honor them, it's good for us.
And where's it going to be held here?
It's at St. Peter's and Paul. It's at 7 o'clock.
You haven't done one if you want to do this. It's up to you.
7 o'clock in the evening?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 7 p.m. Mm-hmm.
So that's, wait. That's,
the night is on a Saturday.
Saturday.
I'm already taken.
You're taken.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we have, you know, given them the plaque, which is very nice.
It's a very nice ceremony. If you've never had the opportunity to do
that. We're sending a staff member to that. If you want us to take something.
Yes. Please, get it from Kate.
I will plan to go, but if something changes, I'll let you know.
Okay.
So if you want to let us know, one of my staff members is going to that.
Right, okay.
So we can help you.
Yeah.
And then, I guess it would have been last Sunday, Jack Oliphant, they had one for him. Did anybody go to that one?
I had to. I was ill, but I sent it to Falk Union Church. It was at Falk Union in D. Took it down because I was going, but I was ill in bed, so I couldn't go.
Next time if something happens like that, just let one of us know.
Yeah, it was a day after Thanksgiving that I came down.
Probably
showed up in camouflage.
Yeah. Probably need to update the Boy Scouts to let them know that Mr. Mike Sheridan is no longer chairman.
Yeah, I know, I see. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Anything else we want to pull? So we've got that straight. Can we have
a motion?
Mm-hmm.
Make a motion to approve.
All right. Do we have a second?
Second.
All right. Motion by Ms. Sheridan, second by Mr. Bryant. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. And now we have new business. Nonprofit presentation. Did you all get your little booklet from nonprofits? Our new supervisors get this little booklet. Because they present, do a little preview. Okay, Mr. Dahl?
Yeah, just really quick here. So we were supposed to have nonprofit presentations the next meeting, December 20th, and at the last board meeting, we heard the board say we want to push all nonprofits until the new year when all the new board is in place. And so unless we heard something incorrectly.
That's probably the best thing to do because we have 2 new members coming on just so that they're included and they get to hear.
So here's the thing that we're just trying to get some guidance on. So for January, so on the January 17th meeting, we already have nonprofit presentations at 5 p.m. Then we have, so 5 to 6:30, we have nonprofits. And then we have regular meeting from 7 p.m. on. So that means we would have to do another, because we can't do it at the first meeting in January, because we already had the solar work session at that. So what that means is we would have to do a special meeting for nonprofit presentations in January. And the only day that I see that would either be, it would either be the 10th, the 24th, or the 31st. And honestly, I would probably recommend the 24th, if that's possible. We could do the nonprofit presentation. We either can do it here, or we can just do it in the Morrisher, because it's just nonprofit presentations.
We used to do the dinner at the Morris Room, right?
What's that?
We used to do a dinner at the Morris Room.
They haven't done a dinner for a good while.
Since COVID.
Yeah.
Since COVID.
Dinner is in council dinner.
I think you're talking about IAC dinner.
Oh, okay. Is that
dinner? Yeah, but that's the nonprofits.
Well, yes, but this is what I'm talking about. You would have nonprofits coming to do their budget requests, presentation. Yeah. So normally we do it, you know, before or after these meetings.
I'm just trying to get a free meal.
Yeah, they always give a meal and then they make presentations.
So, again, we either have January 10th, January 24th, or January 31st. And again, we already have board meetings on the 3rd and the 17th. So we would need to do a special meeting just for those presentations. So trying to get some guidance from the board, what day works for the board.
I agree with the 24th.
24th, that's good.
Would that be at 5 p.m.?
That's up to you all. I mean, I would suggest that we could do a 5 p.m. in the Morris Room. That would probably work best.
Well, if we've got budget briefs that are going on, I don't know. I mean, that's,
when?
You got budget briefs.
No. What that's going to be, that's where I give the budget briefs to.
202.
Oh, yeah.
101.
The 202, 101.
Or are you saying on the 31st?
Well, I'm just saying if people are going to be called in for that already, it might make sense to just do the budget brief and then go right into the meeting after that. That's my thought.
So, we could do the 31st, too.
I'm good with it. Well, I don't know. That could be a harder, well... I got some stuff coming up at the end of that, of January, but...
I mean, we could be looking at snow, too, so we might not be able to do it. If we do the 24th, I mean, not that I'm sitting here as a school teacher wishing for snow, Dr. But if that happens, I will not be heartbroken with the amount of snow days we had last year.
I know it's not any good.
None. Negative.
Yeah.
All right, anyway. I'd say the 24th, and that way we got the 31st.
Honestly, kind of board guidance on this is a little, because you got two members that aren't going to be here, so.
That would be my only thing. If we do the 24th, if we end up getting weathered out, then we just make it the 31st. Yeah. That gives us a
cover. We can acknowledge one of the coming board members. Yeah.
Flexible.
He's retired. He's flexible. Look, he's working five jobs.
I do have fire one, though.
All right, so why don't we just plan for the 24th? If something drastically changes, then we'll plan for 24th. Yeah. At 5 p.m. in the Morris Room?
Looks for me.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now do we have Tommy?
All right. Oh, public comment.
Public comment. Okay, I have to do that. I put my little thing on there. Let me see here. All right, we are now open our second comment. If you'd like to speak to the board, come to the lecture and give your name and address, and you have 5 minutes to speak to the board. Anyone? Seeing no one, I will close the second public comment, and we will go to a session.
Madam Chair, I move the Atlantic County Board of Supervisors into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2-3711A1 and Section 2-3711A8 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for purposes of discussing personnel, the county administrator's performance, and legal matters, Aqua Virginia rate increase.
All right, do we have a second? We have a motion by Mr. Bryant to go in closed session. Second by Mr. Sheridan. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? We are now in closed session.
Madam Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned to the Atlantic County Board of Supervisors to convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge, one, only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950, as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were discussed and considered in the meeting.
Second. Motion by Mr. Bryan, second by Mr. Fairchild. Look me to you and call me sure. You're both, please.
Yes.
Mr. O'Brien.
Aye.
Ms. Sheridan.
Aye.
And Ms. Booker. Aye.
I vote to motion we extend the meeting until 9:22. It's 9:19.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Make motion to adjourn.
So Mr. O'Brien emailed a question to Mr. Dahl that I responded to, but we said we could discuss it tonight. So the question is, when board members email each other, does that constitute a meeting? Which it doesn't under FOIA. The FOIA council's put out an opinion. All the board members can email within 5 minutes of each other, but it's still not considered a meeting. It's not at the same time. It's not instantaneous. So basically, if you reply all to an email, it's a matter of public concern, and maybe the response is subject to FOIA, but it's not a meeting. So you're not violating the meeting rule.
Yeah.
I mean, any vote obviously has to take place at a meeting,
Right.
But it's not considered.
I mean, if there's indication of the board that said, well, maybe I'm thinking this or that, again, that's still not a formal vote. I mean, whatever formal vote would have to be here.
Yeah.
I asked the same question the first month on the board, and you checked with Fred, who said, no, don't do it.
I can show you the FOIA opinion where it says not a meeting.
I mean, Fred took the very conservative approach. So, you know, part of this was, and Chris, you're very vocal, you're very responsive to constituents and so on, you know, which is great. But on the other hand, I think with Linda's request, you said, well, I wouldn't be in favor of that. Which, you know, if we all got in the habit of doing it, I would see that as kind of proxying before, which...
What he's saying is
Chris can't do that.
Yeah.
Fred used to say you shouldn't do that. My opinion is that it's probably not in the best interest of proxying in advance.
Well, it could look bad because it is subject to FOIA. If someone FOIA'd all Mr. Fairchild's emails to the board in the last week, that email would show up and it would look bad.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why Mr. Payne said don't do it, just because it's a public record and it could be FOIA-able. So,
I hate to interrupt. I make a motion we extend to 9:25.
Second. All right. We have a motion to extend to 9:25. All in favor? Any opposed? Okay.
We got 2 minutes.
What happened with Mike asked the question about Mrs. Linda Lenders? Did we make a decision on that?
No, we withdrew.
She withdrew it. I didn't say what. Oh. Wow.
Make a motion to adjourn.
We need a second. All right, we have a motion to adjourn. A second by Mr. Fairchild, all in favor.
Aye.
And Chair says aye. So y'all, please.